this is the most important rat. It comes down to making out. Whenever possible, put on side one of...
Rock All Over You Podcast! Let's rock! Eric and Edwin. Edwin and Eric, they don't give a fuck. They just want you to rock. Yeah. Bam, 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 dilly dee. Bam, bam, bam!
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Rock All Over You Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Jordan, RMCP, and with me, as always, is Mr. Eddie Canastracci.
Yeah, Eddie Canastracci here. And we're talking about the fucking Beatles.
Fucking Beatles, baby.
Yeah. So you guys all like the Beatles, right? Everyone out there?
Yeah. Who's this other guy with us? I think he likes the Beatles, too.
Oh, I know he loves the Beatles. He's got a fucking raging boner for the Beatles. It is
That's for us.
It's Charles Trevor-Noir.
Yeah. The Irish-French guy is back again. And that's a joke that nobody will get because there's a hidden episode out there lost in some space. But yes, Charles Trainer back. And I'm glad to be back, guys, on a band that I really, really love. Not that I don't love GNR, but...
Or Oasis.
Well, yeah.
But we didn't do an Oasis episode. No. Yeah, Charles was, of course, on our GNR one. But Charles referred to a lost episode, yeah. He was on another Beatles episode that we did record. We recorded with the Beatles, a review with the Beatles, the album. Yeah. Well, if you don't count... I would count Hard Day's Night as their... third album, so yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a quasi soundtrack, but yeah, that's our third album. So, but we did the second album with the Beatles, and Eric lost it. I'm sorry to put it on you, Eric, but you know, tell people what happened.
Man, so I had that episode, and it was a long ass episode. I think it went for like 4 hours, man, like 4 freaking hours. And so basically, what happened was it was like on a Sunday night, and I had, like, work the next day, and we recorded late, so, like, you know, by the time we finished that episode, man, I was, like, ready to pass out, you know, and I had to be in bed for work. So when that episode closed, I think I just shut off my computer, like, to go to bed right away, and I didn't realize I didn't save it, and usually I'll save it on both my phone and on the computer, so I have two different versions to go to. But I was just so tired, so out of it. You know, I had a couple drinks. And like I said, it was Sunday. And my concern was like, fuck, I need to be up tomorrow at like, you know, 7:30. And so I just shut off the computer without even thinking. And didn't think to save the episode on the phone. And well, I also didn't save the episode on the phone. So I'm like, oh, I got saved on the computer. It's fine. I didn't have enough memory on my phone. And when I went to go edit, like a couple weeks later, it was gone. And I told Edwin, I'm like, hey, man, looks like we lost that episode.
Yeah, it was funny. Yeah. I could sense you were very hesitant to tell me. It's like, so this thing happened.
But deep down, I felt some relief because, man, that was going to be a bitch of an episode to edit. Oh, my God.
Yeah, but Charles is happy because he gets to...
I'm happy to have been part of a lost episode. That was...
Yeah, a very special achievement.
It's our first official... Now, we do have an episode that we have not put out yet, but it's not lost. We have one with Vincent Cavanaugh. But a very early one.
Very early one.
Yeah, Billy Idol, Rebel Yell. And we do intend to put that out one day, but we have to create an intro for it. And it's just like when the time's right, like we kind of wanted to have one episode as a break glass if you need in case of emergency.
We want to be special. We want to be like built up, like, oh, there's this episode out there that no one's heard yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's that episode. But that is not a lost episode. Charles, you were on an officially lost episode.
Like, it's gone.
Yeah, and so... Yeah, and a shout-out to Kate Doré, another French person. Kate was actually on that episode. That's part of the reason why it was 4 hours long. It was way too many people. We had too many people to talk about Beatles album. It was foolishness on our part, for one thing. But since Eric lost it, he didn't have to edit it. So, you know, Yeah, I think subconsciously he lost on purpose, but that's just a theory. Just a theory.
Well, if I may, just real quick, throw a shout out to Kate and Jerry Supe and Andy Rodriguez. We're looking forward to your Three Shots Down podcast.
Yeah, I'm looking forward. I think that might be out by the time this comes out. So I'll, definitely looking forward to listening to what those three have cooking, because I'm fans of all three of them. I think that's awesome. And yeah, Charles, and thank you for coming on at such late, short notice, because this was kind of a spontaneous thing. Like, we owed you a Beatles episode, as far as I was concerned, because we lost the other one. It's like, we owe you one. And then we suddenly came to the point. This is, I think, the first time this has happened, Eric, since we started this podcast. This is the first time where we had, like, we were coming upon a week where we actually didn't have a new episode. Unless we dusted off the Rebel Yell. We were about to dust off the Rebel Yell. We were coming upon that. But then I thought, I feel like Rebel Yell's a little more of a October-November episode.
Yeah, it is. Somewhere out there, Vincent Cavanaugh's driving his big semi-truck like, damn it!
Sorry. And then I thought, well, we owe Charles a Beatles episode, and fuck it, let's just call up Charles. He's usually game, and you were, so thank you, sir. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you. And you could have told me yesterday, and I would have been like, okay, because I can talk about any Beatles album at the drop of a dime. That's not even a problem.
Yeah, that's why I figured. I figured it'd be a real easy album for you. You wouldn't have to do a lot of homework, because this is your favorite band of all time. Like, correct me if I'm wrong, don't you love the Beatles even more than Oasis?
Correct. There's the Beatles, and then there's everybody else. And Oasis is definitely in the wheelhouse, heavily influenced, and makes sense why I like them so much. But by far, originally, when I was a kid, I was like probably a lot of other kids. I had multiple things I was into. Like, the wrestler Sting meant more to me than the musician Sting when I was a kid. But when music clicked, it was, of all bands, Guns N' Roses.
Yeah.
But just like I remember hearing Eddie's analysis of Spaghetti Incident, which isn't a great album by any stretch of the imagination, but it opened the door to all those great punk songs. Right, Eddie?
Yeah, that's the thing. A lot of that. But sometimes it could be a good EP or album, like Garage Days Revisited, that does the same thing, but it's actually good. But Spaghetti Incident did do that without being good. So
right. At least it did. And GNR to me was the band that lit the fire for me to be passionate about music. So that's why I always hold them in high regard. But the Beatles, once I was infected with the Beatle bug, as I like to say it, it was over. It was over. And also Cobain's suicide. I just, like I said, fuck it. I'm tired of modern music and people that don't want to be stars. And I'm just going to go back. And the Beatles just, that was perfect time. Because the anthology came out the next year. And it was it was like the second coming of Beatlemania when the anthology came out.
So. Oh, I remember. I'm not gonna dwell on this too much because I talked about it in a past Beatle episode. But I remember when that came out. I was like in first grade. And I just remember watching TV in my room, and it was the anthology came out, and then like that Red album, the number one album, come out. I just remember. Every day on TV, you'd see the commercials for that album and then the anthology. And it was just so cool because, like, these commercials just showed the whole evolution of the band. They played snippets of songs, but they're showing the whole evolution of the band, like how they looked at the beginning to, like, their whole transition. And it was just so amazing. And then hearing, too, like, the songs, how those changed. And it was just so phenomenal. I'm like, really? That's the same band? There's just always something that, just even, like, the look. Like, the looks they had, and the fact that they did it in such a short period of time, it was just always so, like, it fascinated me a lot, and that's really what kind of made me go out and listen to a lot of their songs, was just, is that fascination, man. There's something about the Beatles that just, it fascinates me.
Yeah. But I don't think any band in the history of rock and roll progressed at that level in 7 years.
And so naturally, too. Like, it wasn't, like, forced. It just was so natural and organic.
Yeah, that was one thing I was going to bring up, even with this album. We'll talk more about this album later, Beatles for Sale. But I kind of think of Beatles for Sale as the first transition album. Like, they have a lot. Like, they don't just have one tradition. Like, a lot of people talk about, like, just Rubber Soul or Revolver. And I'm like, well, the Beatles, when you really think about it, they have, like, four transitional albums, like, in a row. It's like Beatles for Sale, Leads to Help, Leads to Rubber Soul, Leads to Revolver. Like, in that just 64 to 65, you know, that two-year period with two albums a year, they changed so much, you know? And I really do think it kind of starts in earnest with this album.
Oh, I agree.
With the first couple songs on the album.
I especially do.
Listening to it again, like listening to it again this week, I was just like, wow, this is like, you know, it's still technically, I guess you could say, the Beatlemania era, but it's very, like, musically, it's like, you know, if you really listen to these songs, man, it's like, you know, it's a dark album, like, lyrically, it's dark. I mean, yeah.
And it's the first one that brings in, I would say, the post-Dylan influence, like, there's folky element.
Yeah, because I believe this is, you know, a lot of people say it's Help where Dylan introduced them to the campus, but I actually believe it was this album, well, they record this one, where he introduced them to marijuana.
Yeah, that would make sense, especially, you know, and we'll get into this when we talk about the tracks, but there's one song in particular, which I'm sure we're all thinking about, which definitely sounds like John Lennon's, like, Eureka post-Dylan, post-marijuana song.
Oh, yeah. There's one song, too, where I believe Paul even mentioned he was inspired to write it from taking marijuana.
Yeah, so this is where it's slowly but surely, like, obviously there are a lot of elements about it. They're also still one foot into the old rock and roll, like, era Beatles, but it's definitely the first step in that direction. And then obviously each album subsequently, they take that step even more, like More and Help, then Rubber, you know, Soul and Revolver. That's the only thing that sometimes gets me. I don't know if this is something you've noticed, Charles. Sometimes some of these retrospectives about the Beatles, and when people talk about the Beatles, they kind of act like Sgt. Pepper kind of was like this big, like, surprise, like an overnight thing. And it's just like, you know, it's kind of like every album kind of sets it up. Like, Revolver definitely sets up Sgt. Pepper. And then, of course, you got the singles, too. I think the singles, and again, you could... We'll talk a little bit at the end of this about the singles that were released, you know, coinciding from these sessions. Every set of A-side, B-side singles from these transitional albums kind of was a big leap forward as well.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know.
Well, I don't know about one of the singles here, but yeah.
I'm not talking about the album track single. I'm talking about, Ice Feel Free. Feels
Forever was probably...
Yeah,
honestly, more advanced than the majority of the songs on Pepper, if you ask me.
Oh, yeah, that was, to me, that's an even bigger leap. But I'm referring to, fuck it, we're keeping this loose, we'll talk about it now. I'm talking about I Feel Free and She's a Woman.
I Feel Fine.
I confused it with the Cream song.
I love that song, too.
That's a great song, too. But yeah, I Feel Fine and She's a Woman... to me, that's a very significant leap forward with the Beatles sonically. Like, I Feel Fine actually has feedback in the beginning, and
song with feedback too, by the way.
Yeah, and that's a statement. Like, their singles were a statement. Usually, it was like Lennon had one cut, you know, McCartney had another cut, and then you have with the next album with Help. You know, it's like, I think. Well, I mean. It depends on what version, the UK or US version, but, you know, Yesterday, you know, was a single, that was a big leap forward. And then you have, of course, Rubber Soul, you have Day Tripper and We Can Work It Out, you know, which was a big, and then with Revolver, you got Paperback Writer and Rain, and then you had Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane, you know, as a precursor to Sgt. Pepper. I mean, I think the singles alone are, show you, tracks the evolution, you know?
Oh, it does.
And then also back then they were still of the mindset that the single has to be important and it has to be, you know, a big statement, because they were still, you know, the prevailing wisdom of that industry at that time was the kids are what buys it and the singles are typically what they buy. So there was a lot of effort put into those singles. Yeah. It's kind of well, I guess Hard Day's Night did have a few album cuts as singles, of course. Can't Buy Me Love and Hard Day's Night. But they didn't do that a lot. They didn't do that quite often. So to have single come off this album, and the analysis of this is, I think this is like the genesis of them moving forward, especially more in the instrumentation. I think there's some instrumentation choices on Beatles for Sale that definitely foreshadows areas they're going to go to, but they definitely had, like, they weren't quite there yet. I don't think they were quite ready or something, or who knows, but yes, they were definitely, that's very good analysis. I think Help is a bigger point to the future.
I
think that's the pivot point.
Like I said, this is like one step, Helps two steps, Rubber Soul's three steps, Revolver's four steps. That's kind of how I see it. Like, each step gets you there.
Yeah, I mean, for this one, it's like, you know, I never really noticed the difference, you know, until more recently. And I think that's because, you know, when I was, you know, preparing for this episode, I was really looking into the lyrics a lot. And man, the lyrics are pretty, like, they're kind of a lot darker on this one, you know, like, up until then, like, a lot of the Beatles songs are a little bit more happier, a little bit more boy meets girl, and, you know, this one has a lot more, like, you know, dealing with breakups and, like, you know, the bad side of, like, relationships. They're still singing about love in a lot of these songs, but it's more like the darker side of love, like when love doesn't go right, you know, which I'll highlight, you know, when we talk about a few songs. And even on the album cover, you can tell this band is just, they're fried, man. I mean, you look at that album cover, man, they just look exhausted, and they just finished, you know, doing all this touring, making A Hard Day's Night the movie, three albums, all these singles, and it's just like, and you know, they blew up, man. I mean, they're huge. They, you know, people are going, like, you know, crazy over them. All these girls chasing after them, you know. I mean, they're fried, man, and you can tell by the album cover, man. That's a band that's just, like, you know, done so much work in just a short period of time, and they're exhausted.
Yeah, that's very good. I'm glad you brought that up, Eric, because that's another thing, because, and you also talked about their image earlier too. I think another, you know, piece of evidence that this is a transitional album and displays their evolution is the album cover as well.
Oh, yeah. But,
yeah, I mean, it's actually my favorite photo of the Beatles, is this album
cover. It's a great photo. It's George Harrison with the onion on his
head. Yeah, onion on the head. These just sad, kind of exhausted, spent, blank expressions from the Beatles. I think that's the thing is, generally people say, they describe it as they look like kind of gloomy or like frowning. But I think, I actually think it's darker than gloomy because, like you just said, cold. I see it's more like they're almost blank, like detached, like they're drained. Yeah. Almost like vampires.
Exactly, man.
Yeah, it's like pre-goth. Like Bauhaus would look like this on a photo.
At that time, Eddie, they, like Eric said, they had just come off like some major touring, made film, Hard Day's Night. And this was their second LP of 1964.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the pace these guys were going at, man. Two fucking albums a year, minimum. It's incredible what these guys were doing. And they were completely burnt the fuck out. And I'll probably make the argument, I think it comes through on a few songs.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, so, and I guess, I mean, we'll get into, I mean, I don't know if you mean that in a positive way or a negative way. Or maybe both with this album.
Way, yeah. But they were definitely burnt, I think. I think they went on vacations after this, and I don't blame them.
Oh, yeah, and half
hairs.
And there are a lot of covers on it, more so than on Hard Day's Night, which I actually don't. There wasn't one cover on Hard Day's Night.
There was not.
Not at all. I love that album, too. I love Hard Day's Night.
Oh, yeah, it's my favorite of the early Beatles, and it's the only Beatles LP EMI release with only Lennon and McCartney written songs. The only one.
Yes.
Yeah, so obviously, and I know this album has a bad rep. And we'll talk a little bit
It's actually like majority of these songs are like, you know, there's a list of like the least played Beatles songs like on Spotify. And this, like a majority of the list songs at the bottom are from this album. And it's also too, man, I mentioned it in the Lost episode. I really feel like this era of the Beatles, because this is still technically Beatlemania era.
Yeah.
I feel like this era is just so underrated. Like, anyone I know that loves the Beatles, like, especially, like, in high school, all kids that like the Beatles, everything was all about Rubber Soul and everything after Rubber Soul. And I feel like people just really neglected this era. Like, you know, like, oh, it's just a bunch of love songs. They're like a boy band, basically. Like, no, it's all about this shit. You know, it's like, no, this shit's genius, man. Like, you know, yeah, maybe it sounds like a bunch of love songs. They sound like kind of a boy band, maybe. But, I mean, that stuff was revolutionary for the time, man. No one else was doing stuff like they were doing at that time, even in the Beatlemania era. And I feel it's very overlooked. You know, a lot of people, when they had those two albums, the Red Album and the Blue Album, like the greatest hits. A lot of people always like talk about they like the Blue Album better. I was one of the few people or I like the Red Album better. Something about the simplicity of those songs, like in the early days, I really loved, man. I love that Beatlemania era. It's so underrated. And I feel you can't really truly appreciate the later stuff without the early stuff. If you don't have the early stuff to go off, like when you have the early stuff to go off of, it makes the later stuff just seem that much more genius, that much more revolutionary, you know? So I really hope people that maybe feel that way that don't really give the earlier stuff a chance, I hope after this review they go back and give some of those albums a chance, because the Beatlemania era is fucking phenomenal and so underrated.
I agree. I know all three of us agree with that. That's the thing. We love all the Beatles, including the early stuff. The only thing I disagree, it's a minor disagreement, Eric. I agree with everything you said. But although I think you will agree with me once I say this. Yeah. I think that it's their music in the early days is deceptively simple. I don't really think it's simple. It seems like it's simple because lyrically, yeah. Lyrically, it's more simplistic. It's boy meets girl.
Oh, there's some complex instrumentation on it. But.
In terms of the musicianship, in terms of the chords they use, the melodies they're singing, it's actually more complicated. Like, that's funny thing. Like, not production. I'm not talking about production. Like, yeah, Sgt. Pepper and the White Album, Abbey Road, they got more like, you know, they got like orchestras and George Martin's doing some more stuff. And obviously the lyrics are more complicated. But if you're talking in terms of just the musicianship and like the chords they're using, and this is something Paul McCartney has cited several times in interviews, I'm sure Charles knows this, is McCartney said, hey, we were always disappointed that critics and people weren't like paying attention to what we were doing musically in the early days. Like, we were like taking the time to write these really interesting chord progressions and stuff like that. Some other musicians took note, like Bob Dylan took note that they were doing interesting things musically.
Yeah.
But a lot of like critics and things weren't really paying attention, and the fucking girls didn't care. They were just screaming because they thought the Beatles were hot, you know?
Exactly. So they're young, good-looking guys singing about, like, you know, like falling in love, and
they're singing about me. But the Beatles were taking the time to really they were like, you know, these chords, and I know as a musician, as a former musician, I could always figure out the basic chords to like post like songs from the White Album, for example. They were using pretty basic chord progressions on those songs, but I tried playing like early Beatles songs. I was like, I don't know what they're fucking doing. I can't make my guitar sound like this.
Well, you're a bass player too, man. Paul McCartney, man. Paul McCartney is so underrated as a bass player because everyone just talks about his singing and his songwriting, which is amazing. But man, people really underestimate his skills as a fucking bassist, man. I mean, he is fun. He's my number one favorite bass player.
Yeah, I'm thinking about it. He's up there. He's definitely in the top five. And I think Paul is to bass, I think, kind of what Jimi Hendrix is to guitar.
I agree heavily. I think he's phenomenal.
Yeah, I think in the same way Hendrix essentially invented modern hard rock guitar playing.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, maybe Jeff Beck. It's Jeff Beck or Jimi Hendrix, one of those two. But Paul McCartney, there's no one even close to Paul, in my opinion. Paul definitely created modern hard rock, like modern rock bass playing. Like,
totally.
Especially once he got the Rickenbacker. But even before that, I think Paul is he's probably the most important bassist for modern rock music. And, yeah, I mean, people in the know, but it's not something he's, like, universally known for. I mean, what do you think of that, Charles?
That's Lennon used to say that he always said Paul was an egomaniac about everything but his bass playing, and he was very coy about his bass playing. He's like the best bass player in rock. He's my favorite bass player.
Yeah, I gotta say he's my favorite, man. It's overshadowed because, like, a lot of people don't really seem to care about bass playing, And two, he's also just such a great singer and songwriter as well that it just overshadows his bass playing, in my opinion.
Listen to his wings work as well. I mean, he just kept going on and on. He's also my favorite guitarist in the Beatles. The best guitar player in the Beatles.
He's the second best. I don't know. I used to think that. I bounce between. He definitely has some of the... He has some good solos. He definitely shreds a little more. By 60 standards, he's like more of a hard rocking guitarist than George Harrison. That's why he does the guitar solo in Taxman, because he rocks out more than George does. George is a more restrained player, but if you're a fan of, I think, you know, Charles, you like a lot of 50s rock. You love like Scotty Moore, Elvis type stuff. Yeah, I feel George Harrison though. If you're talking about that style, George Harrison plays with a little more dexterity and skill, I think. He's real, especially, we'll talk about this with this album. George Harrison really nailed that style, that 50s style rockabilly guitar playing. He's really skilled at that. Paul can kind of do that, but I feel like Paul's more of a hard rock guitarist, and George Harrison's more of a rockabilly guitarist.
I agree.
And I think that's even why in his solo career in the 70s, he would bring in Clapton to kind of do the hard rock solos.
Also when he found that slide, because I think he's one of the greatest slide players.
Yeah, he's good at slide. He's good at the rootsier stuff, I guess you could say. Country, rockabilly, blues. I think if you're looking at country, rockabilly, and blues, he's a superior player than Paul. Paul's a superior player for hard rock. You know, so it depends. John, I would say musically, like in terms of his instrumentation, and John would probably be the first to admit this, even though he's an egotist. John is probably, he would probably put himself ahead of Ringo. He used to make those Ringo cracks. Although I always thought John was very unfair when he made that remark about Ringo not being the best drummer in the Beatles. Because I think Ringo's I think we both agree with, all of us agree with that too.
He's an amazing drummer. He's so very underrated.
Very underrated drummer. You know, and when Paul copied style, he was copying Ringo's style. Ringo had a very specific style.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Actually, I think, obviously an amazing singer, an amazing songwriter, but if I were to say musically who's the weak link, it's John. John's like the only guy, even he does what he needs to do, you know, because he's a songwriter. And I'm not saying that he hasn't had some cool, hard, you know, some good guitar bits. Actually, I think probably his best guitar works probably on the Plastic Ono Band album, because he's pretty much carrying that as the only guitarist, as the rhythm guitarist. And he does create a really cool proto-punk, kind of proto-grunge, these proto-punk guitar lines, which are really cool and innovative. But before that, he definitely was the weakest guitarist of the three guitar playing Beatles, I would say.
You know why you have a hard time playing what he played in those early days? Because he was still playing banjo fucking chords.
That is true. He learned the banjo from his mom. It was part of the sound.
He's unorthodox for the longest time. But I would say, though, I Want to Hold Your Hand, he drove that song. That was maybe his best rhythm work ever on one of the... I mean, it's just phenomenal. He's crushing it.
Yeah.
And he did play a great solo on Get Back. But overall, I think he was the weakest guitarist in the band. And I don't think he was... I think Paul was a better piano player, too.
Yeah, Paul's definitely a stronger piano player. Yeah. John does what he needs to do. He services the song. He's talented enough that he could play the instrument, the lead instrument on whatever song he needs to do, and it works. But Paul just had that little extra layer of musicianship. Like, you look even like things he did for other people's songs, like George Harrison, While My Guitar Gently Weeps. That little piano refrain that Paul adds in, it just has so much atmosphere to it, you know?
It does.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. But John was quoted as saying, I am not the greatest guitar player, but I make it howl and move. That's what you need.
Yeah, that's John, he's one of the greatest songwriters of all time and one of the greatest vocalists. That's where he shined the most. And he was the driving force of the Beatles during the early days.
After Sgt. Pepper really became Paul's band, whereas in the early days, man, it was really, John was like kind of the leader.
Yeah, I agree with that. The only exception being, I feel they're fighting for dominance on the White Album.
Yeah, that's good. Well, that's kind of like everyone is kind of trying to get their piece of the pie on that one.
Yeah, because it's a more of a hard rock album. Because of that, John gets to shine more. But when they do the more theatrical, symphonic-driven albums like Abbey Road, Sgt. Pepper, Mystery Tour, Paul's going to shine then. In that regard, but if you do straight up rock albums, that's where John's like, okay, back off, Mac, and let me show you how it's done.
It's a fascinating period because I think this album is still quite Lennon dominated, and not quite as much as A Hard Day's Night, but still a bit. And
I agree.
The best part of the Get Back film was when McCartney told him, "You're still the leader of the band." So, I mean, that's the part that I loved. Because, you know, it's always Paul and John didn't get along, or Paul didn't look up to him anymore. Bullshit. Paul looks up to John to this day. I mean, he was the leader of the band, regardless. Even in those eras where, I mean, John just got too busy doing heroin and writing weird shit. And Paul kept him going.
Paul was like the jilted girlfriend that he wanted to keep it going, you know?
He was, yeah.
You know, John was the one that got like a new play partner. Like, I got, because, you know, he was like, Linda wasn't a musician. I mean, Paul kind of, I think in competition with John, decided to push her in front of a piano and make her sing. But, you know, the different, John found another, you know, person to collaborate with. He wanted to do different things with Yoko. He wanted to do more avant-garde kind of music. And he just, you know, he was just kind of tired. I mean, some of it's the drugs, you know, the heroin. But I do think John was just kind of bored of the Beatles. Like, he just wanted to do different shit, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas Paul,
Paul just wanted to keep it going, man.
He wanted them to tour. He wanted them to, like, be what the Stones were, you know, essentially.
Yeah. Get Back, man. I mean, he was, like, getting emotional, you know, a lot in those scenes, man, crying because, like, you know, it just, you know, seeing this sinking ship and he's trying to keep it floating, and it just, he knows, like, deep down, you can't do anything about it.
Yeah. And then he gets, you know, spiteful because, the band rejects him, essentially. And it really, it's John. I mean, I feel even as sour as George was getting during that period, I still think George and Ringo would have went with the majority. You know, if John was like, let's keep this going, I think they would. And I'm not saying they wouldn't have had solo projects on the side and stuff. You know, surely George would have had some solo projects on the side to get some more of his songs out there. But I think they would have kept... They would have stayed in the
They would have stayed. George would have stayed.
It was John. John just was done with it. So, and then it was just like, well, John's done with it. Okay, so we'll side with the guy that we like a little bit better because they didn't like Paul. So Paul, it was like then Paul feels, you know, jilted, and Paul's like, "Fuck you, I'm suing you," and it gets ugly for a couple of years. But then funny thing is, I think we talked about this in the Lost episode. John and Paul patched it up. It's actually John and George are the two that never patched it up before John died.
Yep.
Because Paul, I mean, because John actually screwed over George because he told him he was going to do the Bangladesh concert and then last minute decided not to do it and he flew to Paris and he fucked off and George never forgave him for it. Now, John did try to extend an olive branch with the song Number 9 Dream.
And
there is a little refrain where Mei Pang, people think it's Yoko, it's actually Mei Pang, does "I'm sorry, George," like it's actually in that song if you listen to it. So he was like, you know, that's John's like kind of way of extending an olive branch. It's possible George never even noticed.
just for the record, Mang Pang, or is that how you pronounce her name?
Yeah, Mei Pang.
Way more beautiful than Yoko. Oh my gosh, why didn't John stick with her?
She also encouraged John to get back with Paul.
Oh, what the heck?
Yeah, with Paul. Oh. Yeah, she was like, yeah, fucking jam with that Paul McCartney guy.
Yeah,
John was going to be, a lot of people don't know this, this is a funny thing, we discussed a little bit about this on the Lost episode. I'm not a Yoko hater, like some people, but if people knew some of the shit about Yoko, they would hate her more. Even though I don't put on Yoko. I put on John. It's, you know, John.
Right, it was John's decision. I mean, Yoko is not the greatest influence, you know, and she has no talent. But, you know, it was ultimately John's decision. John was going to make that decision regardless.
I think Yoko is a different kind of artist. You know, I do think Yoko had some talent, but not for like conventional rock music. No, it's a different thing. It's like, you know, you don't go to Picasso and tell him to make a comedy movie. You know what I mean? Like this, like,
yeah.
Yoko shouldn't be singing on like Blue Suede Shoes or something. You know, it's just, it's a different kind of thing. You know, but I do like some of her work. But that being said, Yoko definitely. Like, it comes down to John, but Yoko definitely did not like John having that relationship with Paul.
Yeah.
And obviously she would have more power over him if he was away from the Beatles. Whereas May Pang encouraged it. And
he also connected Julian back with John, too.
Yeah, May Pang was trying to... I mean,
oh, she was, like, perfect for him. He probably would still be alive if he stayed with her.
Eric, why won't Yoko get with Sammy Hagar and do a beer run with Vince Neil?
Oh, my God, yes, please. Please, for the love of God.
Well, do you know about the Venus and Mars thing, Charles? Because everyone really hate Yoko if they knew about this.
Oh, no, I don't know about this.
John was going to be on the album.
Oh, come on!
Yeah.
That's a good album, too.
Yeah, it was good even without John. But John, John had done Walls and Bridges. He was moving in a more, kind of closer to what Paul was doing. Like, he was, during that period, in the interviews, John was even saying things like he thought Band on the Run was a great album. Like, a few years later in Playboy, when he did that Playboy interview in 1980, suddenly Paul's post-Beatles stuff was shit again, once he hooked up back with Yoko. Yeah. But if you read his interviews in the mid-70s, he suddenly got very positive and pro-Paul, and he said he thought the drum was great. And if you listen to, especially Walls and Bridges, he's kind of moving back to being kind of doing more melodic pop rock again.
Yeah.
And he was hanging out with Perry Nilsson. He produced a Pussycats album, a great album that I love. And John was, like, really getting into music again. He was hanging out with Alice Cooper. He was partying. He was becoming more rock and roll. Yoko and stuff, there's this whole spin now that they call it the Lost Weekend, you know? They try to make this period seem like a bad period for John, but he was actually the most prolific he was ever in his solo career.
Oh, yeah, for real.
He knocked out two albums, which he produced Mind Games, and I think even though that album's, you know, a little half and half, it's not one of his best albums, but there are some great songs on it. That title track's amazing. And he produced it, and he actually made it sound like a Spectre track. You would think that was Phil Spector producing Mind Games. And John produced that. Like, it was an impressive production. Like, he knew how to capture that Phil Spector sound. And on top of that, he produced an album for Harry Nilsson. He did the rock and roll album. He was knocking shit out. He was very prolific. And then on top of that, he was going to go and jam Paul. They were going to do a song on Venus and Mars. There was going to be a Lennon McCartney song on Venus and Mars. But Yoko called up John and said, I will take you back.
Oh, it made pain.
Actually, what she said is, I found a way to quit smoking. That's she called him at Elton John, after the Elton John thing, when I Want to Get You Through the Night or whatever went number one.
Yeah,
and played on stages, version of I Saw Her Standing There they did, and somehow she rang the stage at Madison Square Garden and said, I found a way to quit smoking, and he went back and dropped everything.
That's it. Just, I also forget, during that period, he also did the song of David Bowie. He did Fame.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was very prolific. So, like, there's a spin now that the mid-70s was a period where John was just drunk all the time and away from Yoko. And then he goes back in Yoko, and that leads to Ooh, Double Fantasy and all that. It's bullshit. He was more prolific in the mid-70s, and then he spent 5 years doing nothing before Double Fantasy.
Yeah.
So it's... And I personally, I mean, people are going to differ. I personally prefer the mid-70s John Lennon albums to Double Fantasy, but that's just a matter of taste. But regardless, there's no question that he was more productive without Yoko. He was knocking a lot of shit out, and he was gonna jam with Paul again, and we all know what that would eventually have led to.
I've said it before, say it again. In my opinion, Double Fantasy got the death rub. I don't think if he would not have been killed, that album would have been as held in as in high regard as it is today. Because those songs just took on a whole new meaning now that he's no longer with us. Because
it was kind of like a reminiscing album.
Yeah, like, just like Starting Over is now instantly bittersweet.
Yeah, the whole album became instantly bittersweet.
Right. I still do love that album, except for the Yoko songs. I wish they had a version of it where you get rid of the Yoko songs. It's just John. It's just those Yoko songs are fucking horrible. And it throws off the whole album.
I agree and disagree. I actually prefer the Yoko songs.
Whoa!
but I don't. They should be on their own little Yoko New Wave album. They don't mix in. You know, John's doing this like boomer dad rock and roll.
Yeah, her stuff is like weird avant-garde, like techno-y pop. Disco-ish bullshit.
They don't mash. They definitely
don't. Yeah, it totally throws off the album. Like it should. Like if they should have done something, it should have been like John. Like one album was John's and one album was Yoko's in one package.
I think a lot of people hate it. I think their stuff does work together on Sometime in New York City. They're doing kind of similar music on that album, but yeah, on Double Fantasy, it's just like these are essentially two different albums that they're cramming together. And also, this is the thing too. Listen, it's like this forcing thing. I myself, like I said, I like some of Yoko's stuff, but it's, you know, John's being a dick to force her music on people. Like in Double Fantasy, the way it's sequenced, it's forcing her music. In the early 70s, at least with their two different Plastic Ono Band albums, they're like giving people the option to buy two different albums, you know? Whereas Double Fantasy, especially if you're people that like fucking, you know, Starting Over and Watching the Wheels Go By, you know, you're not gonna like that fucking Yoko stuff, so you're like forcing people to sit through, especially the way they sequenced it, because it's like John song, Yoko song, John song.
I know, Yoko's. Right? I hate that shit.
They're like forcing people to listen to.
There's no flow to it.
Yeah, it's all wrong. If anything, it should have been a double album that were just two different discs, and then, yeah, most people wouldn't have listened to the Yoko disc, but, you know, a few cats like me would have.
I do like Walking on Thin Ice.
I think that's a good song, too. I do like that.
I don't mind. That's about the only song I don't mind hers. But Paul's solo career blew away John's.
Oh, yeah.
Period.
Overall, I agree. I mean, you do have a few high marks. I mean, I love Plastic Ono Band and Walls and Bridges. But overall, I think Paul had a stronger solo career. In just the 70s, mind you. Like, obviously, it's unfair to count afterwards.
Yeah, true.
You know, it's very possible, I think, that John might have owned Paul in the late 80s and wouldn't have taken much.
I think so, too. I think he would have.
Yeah, he might have had to come back.
Should he stayed with Meng Pang.
I think he would have been what Neil Young became, like the godfather of grunge and all that. I think that he could have transitioned into that.
I think he was already kind of stepping in the right direction with the Nobody Told Me single. I think that was...
Oh, I think Milk and Honey is better than Double Fantasy.
I agree with that. I agree. I like the songs. I think he was taking a step in the right direction. I think he was getting a little more hard rock with that stuff.
Yeah. I'm stepping out. It's great. It's fucking awesome. But I don't hate Double Fantasy, though, Eric. I just think a lot of people look at it differently.
Oh, I agree with you. I think it's definitely like it gets a lot more attention because of what happened. Kind of how I feel with the movie The Dark Knight. I feel like it gets so much love because Heath Ledger died. Because I thought Dark Knight was fucking boring as shit, and I was really excited to see that movie.
Well, it's Kurt Cobain. I mean, although I think all that stuff is... All Cobain stuff is great, you know, regardless. But there's no way that you can listen to the songs on In Utero. You can't listen to, like, All Apologies and not think of it as, like, a suicide letter. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for real.
It is. Yeah. I don't get what it says. It is.
You know, and... So it's that context or everything. Like that whole album is like a concept album about how Courtney Love's killing him.
Oh my god, for real. Fuck. I hate Courtney Love. I hate Yoko.
I'm a defender. What can I say?
I also agree with Eddie there. I know.
I'm a Courtney fan. Yeah, me and Trump like Courtney. I think Courtney's great, actually. But, I mean, great to listen to. I'm not saying I want to be married to that crazy junkie. She'll do a great album. Hey, Live Through This is one of the best fucking rock albums in the 90s, in my opinion. But it doesn't mean I want to be married to her.
That might be fun for
Oh, don't get me wrong. So she's hot. I mean, Kurt Cobain himself said she was the best fuck he ever had. He said it on national TV.
God damn.
Allegedly, I read this the other day. Allegedly, she sucked off Ted Nugent when she was
yes!
like.
Yes, I heard I about see. That.
Courtney's Courtney's a wild, crazy freak. Yeah, I'm sure Courtney, whoever Courtney fucks, I'm sure thinks that was the greatest fuck of their life.
Ted Nugent mentions Courtney Love in the Kiss My Ass song.
There you go. She left an impression. I'm a big fan of Courtney. I'm not saying I don't buy into that conspiracy. That's another conspiracy I don't buy into. I don't think for a second that Courtney had anything to do with, directly with Kurt Cobain's suicide. Now, did she drive him to be in such a depressed, crazy state that in a heroin, malaise, he decided to blow his brains out? Yeah, possibly. She was the rumor is that she was cheating on him with Billy Corgan at the time.
I don't think so.
You don't believe that rumor?
No, I think he was just, he had already had mental issues to begin with.
Yeah.
And he was deeply fucking smacked out of his mind. Yeah. Like, deeply. Like, he would have ended up being Layne Staley.
Yeah, I mean, he was always singing about guns and killing himself, so it's just like, I always say, like, if it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck.
All Apologies, I think, is his actual suicide note to the world.
He's a little undecided, though, because he did record that one song later, and he did tell Michael Stipe that he was planning on recording another album, so I don't know. And if you see the interviews during the In Utero tour, he's deceptively upbeat for a period there.
Yeah, at the same time, though, a lot of people that commit suicide are like, a lot of them seem like real happy, man. Sometimes, like, those signs of people are really, like, hurting inside and, like, really wanting to kill themselves. Like, I gotta give a trigger warning. Trigger warning. A lot of those people, man, that usually end up killing themselves are usually the ones that seem the happiest, too, at the same time.
You think it's maybe, like, he resigned himself? Like, oh, great, I'm almost done this shit, so I'm happy. Now I'll just enjoy the last couple months.
Yeah, who knows, man? Who knows, probably.
Definitely
maybe
more upbeat.
Decided to work with Michael Stipe. I don't know.
I mean, I
like Michael Stipe.
I do too. I'm a fan. Automatic for the People was the album he had on before he shot himself. Actually, did you know that?
I mean,
they said that was what was in his like CD changer.
Or say he's gonna break up Nirvana.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. It's interesting to know. I mean, Dave Grohl had started to write songs, whether or not. Like, maybe, they gave him a B-side during the In Utero period. Maybe that's something. Two things were going to happen. Nirvana would have turned into some kind of, Nirvana meets the Foo Fighters, with them both writing songs. Or they were going to split up. I don't know. One of those two things were going to happen.
Yeah.
Kurt might have went off and become, like John Lennon, like you were saying, he might have become like a Neil Young type artist. Like, I could see Kurt Cobain going in that direction because I could see him, because of his success of Unplugged, I could see him mixing in more acoustic stuff with the electric stuff. And I could almost see Kurt Cobain kind of becoming like a alt-country artist. I could see him doing shit like that. You know what I mean?
Same here, yeah.
Yeah, so he might have gone in a different direction.
The REM work, or the Stipe thing, it was supposed to have been acoustic, folky kind of deal. And that was because I still say that Nirvana Unplugged is, if it's not the best, it's certainly one of the best. Much that touches it. And I don't think that came from the death rub. I think that was fantastic. And,
Then there's the single, though. You're Right is very heavy and metallic.
It is, but I also am thankful for I Hate Myself and Want to Die because we got Live Forever from it. Thank you.
Yeah, there you go. Nirvana-inspired Oasis. Anyway, this is interesting. I didn't think we were going to talk so much about Nirvana. Well, Charles, in the future, I would love to do a Nirvana episode. So we might.
Oh, same here, yeah.
We'll have to bring you on for that.
Hopefully Bleach, but yeah, that'd be awesome.
Bleach would be an interesting one to talk about. I love it, and a lot of people don't talk about it. So that might be, and that's obviously the, I would say Bleach or Incesticide would be the two I would want to do, you know, an episode. Well,
yeah, Sliver Rules, I mean.
Dive is one of my favorite Nirvana songs is Dive. I love Dive.
I love all their stuff, but I think Bleach, people overlook it a bit. There's so many fucking classics on that. And
I'm surprised more metalheads don't like Bleach, because it is their most metal album. It's very it's very Sabbath influence, you know?
I think it's a stigma. It's the stigma about Nirvana.
Yeah, like they just won't like it. Like, I feel like if any other band did an album like Bleach, and like that was their only album, like they were a band called like Fuck Not, and they were some metal underground band, you know, half these metalheads would be talking about how awesome Sabbathy it was.
Oh, because I was guilty of hating Nirvana for so long because of that stigma, as you know, me being a heavy me being a metalhead. There's that stigma.
Firehouse, dude.
Okay, oh, man. You gotta love this though. Listen to this for a segue. There's one song though on Bleach that was inspired by the Beatles. That's
you
not
beat me to it. Damn it! It was on the last episode.
Yeah. Well, you say it, Charles. I'll give it to you.
It was about a girl, which was fuck. What? You take the Beatles song, Eddie.
It was the album he was listening to.
Oh, with the Beatles.
He wasn't. It wasn't
the Beatles. It was Meet the Beatles.
Yeah, it was Meet the Beatles, not with the Beatles. He had a record LP of Meet the Beatles. And he said he was listening to it nonstop, like all week long. He became obsessed with that album, and you can hear so much of that on Nevermind. I think Nevermind, you could hear Meet the Beatles. Yeah,
About a Girl is the same chord sequence as God damn it, I can't. It's towards the end of the album. I can't remember the name of the fucking song. I know I'm supposed to be a Beatles fan, but. It is. You can hear that chord sequence. And he said he was taking Ritalin and just listened to that. And then he wrote About a Girl, which is probably one of the best songs on Bleach and one of the best songs on Unplugged, for sure. So.
Oh, yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. And as much as I love that Unplugged version, that studio version is my favorite version. I love the sound of it.
The electric guitar.
Yeah, it sounds great. It has that jingling, a little REM too, musically. It has a little bit of that jingle jangle thing. I think the song you're talking about, is it Not a Second Time?
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you for saving me there.
Yeah, Not a Second Time. Yeah, it has a very similar tone. And that actually, we talked about this album that we're getting into, Beatles for Sale, as being, it's definitely, at that point, I mean, I don't know, you could argue it's the darkest Beatles album even. Like later, I'm not saying the darker songs, but this is fairly dark, especially the first like three songs on this album.
Yeah, it's
pretty dark.
Well, the thing that makes it kind of even darker is the fact that you don't really expect it. It's kind of hidden almost, you know. Later on, like some of the songs where it got darker, it was just very out in your face. Whereas this is like very subtle. It's like kind of almost hidden in a way. Where if you really, really listen to these songs, really listen to the lyrics, I mean, you don't realize how dark it is till you really listen to these songs, like, in depth, you know?
Yeah, I think there are two songs on With the Beatles, All I've Got to Do, and the song we were just talking about, Not a Second Time. I think those songs do foreshadow that kind of darkness a little bit.
Yes. But,
and they're both John Lennon, you know, it comes from John, the darker stuff, obviously. And this is where, this feels like the next step. Like, it feels like he did that, and then you don't really hear that on A Hard Day's Night. Like, he steps away from the darkness a bit, and then he steps back even further. Like, now it's like, yeah, now I'm getting back to the darkness again.
And yeah,
especially the first, oh, fuck it, let's get into this album.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah, if you guys are ready. So yeah, I'm gonna say this is, we're talking about darkness, so let's talk about the fucking opening track. All right, No Reply. Wow. Woo! Whoa. It's that kind of song. I remember the first time I listened to this album. And I had a friend, a buddy of mine, tell you the history. I'm going to tell you the history of when I first listened to this album. And it's going to lead into my thoughts about this song. My friend Fred, shout out to Frederick Seaton. He was my Beatles buddy, you know, in high school. I had a couple Beatles buddies, but Fred was like my main one. And I was just starting to get into their albums. I had started to buy their cassettes. I mainly was buying their cassettes. This was after, this was like the early 90s, I guess you would say. So it was after they started to have that whole, you know, canonization where they started to put out the UK albums in America as well. There was a period. Like, this album was actually not available in America officially until the late 80s, actually. You know?
Damn.
Yeah. I was reading that just today. Yeah, because it was like Beatles, was it, what's the number? Is it six?
I guess the Beatles weren't album. I guess the Beatles weren't for sale.
Yeah, well, not here. Charles, do you know offhand, what's the equivalent Capitol album? It's Beatles 6, I think.
I believe so. And
yeah, and obviously there's a few other songs. It was
Capitol. The Capitol ones are so butchered.
Yeah, but that was the album in America, was that album, not this album. Beatles right. For Sale was just a UK album.
Right, I think like the CDs was like the first release of the EMI versions in the States, and that came out like late 80s sometime.
Yeah, so but when I got into it, it was like Beatles for Sale was part of the discography, you know. It was the UK discography that I got. And but this was, you know, it's like it's probably the least known album in America, I would guess. Maybe this or Please Please Me. I don't know. I mean, what do you think? It's one of those two, I would say, is the, because even Yellow Submarine, it might not be a popular album, but people know that album because of the movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's such an iconic song, whether you like it or hate it. It's an iconic song.
Yeah, and of course, like in these days, Hey Bulldog has a fairly large cult following.
Yes.
I feel like I would say it's either Please Please Me, and I would say it's this album, because like Please Please Me has Twist and Shout, and like I saw her standing there.
I think it's this one.
Yeah, I'd say this is the dark horse. This is the dark horse of the Beatles catalog, if I had to pick one, wouldn't you say? So Charles and me seem to agree. You agree with that, Eric?
I agree, man. I agree.
Yeah, so this is Dark Horse.
Like I mentioned too, this is like, if you go on Spotify, the least listened to Beatles songs, like a majority of it is basically this entire album.
Yeah, and it was even then. This was like one of the last Beatles albums I got.
Oh, this was the last, I was going to mention too, when I got my turn with the song, this is the last album I got by the Beatles.
I listened to it though the first time the best way. My buddy Frederick Seaton was talking about, we were talking about the Beatles, and I pretty much had every album but this album at this point. And he said, oh, you don't have Beatles for Sale? That's a great album. That's an underrated album. So my buddy Fred, to his credit, he was a little hip here. He knew that this was a really cool underrated album. He said, oh, I love that album. It's very underrated. He says, in fact, I have an original copy, Still Sounds Great, on vinyl that my father got down in my basement. We went down to his basement, and he played me Beatles for Sale on vinyl. This was like in the mid-90s. And that's the first time I heard No Reply. I never even heard No Reply before.
Yeah.
Like, you know? And, man, I mean, sometimes it is also about like the setting. Like, yeah, it was down in a cool basement with my buddy, and he was playing, and maybe we're a few scotches in, and he plays me No Reply. But, man, I was blown away. To me it was a little like the first time I heard Nirvana. It was like that chorus when John and Paul do that dual screaming, just like fucking belting it out. And it, like, the song's a little deceptive. It starts off a little kind of romantic, a little of a bossa nova kind of thing.
Yeah,
and you're like, oh, this is a lovey-dovey Beatles song. And kind of a weird opening. Like, it doesn't sound like a song. Like, I was used to things like Hard Day's Night, Help, you know, like more like a clearly defined rocking opening, you know? And this comes on with this kind of bossa nova kind of thing. And I'm like, okay. But then when it hits that chorus and starts screaming No Reply, I'm like, fuck. And it blew me away. And it was so dark. It, like, the song It's like, you know that saying when people go, oh, that escalated quickly?
Yeah, yes.
No Reply is like the song that starts off nice, and then it becomes like this dark stalker murder ballad within seconds.
Oh,
within
yeah,
seconds,
man.
It's like, oh, shit just got real. And I was immediately, and I always have that feeling to a degree every time I listen to this song. I'm always amazed by it. I think it's one of John Lennon's greatest songs. John Lennon considers this his first real song. He said this.
No way.
In interviews. Yeah, he thinks it's his first song. It really is complete, he says. Like, I forget the exact quote. I don't know if Charles knows the quote I'm talking about. But he feels like there's a kind of, in terms of writing, there's a narrative to the song. There's something about it that has a kind of beginning, middle, and ending that he felt it was more sophisticated than anything he had written from a songwriting standpoint. So yeah. at that point, and I definitely can hear what he's talking about. There, it's like a little mini movie, you know?
Yeah.
And it definitely foreshadows, like, yeah, this is the guy that would in, you know, like in just a little over 2 years would be writing like A Day in the Life, you know? Like, yeah, it's kind of beginning here. Like, yeah, I'm not discounting John Lennon's accomplishment, especially on, I would say, A Hard Day's Night, is like he became kind of the perfect pop rock songwriter.
Oh, yeah. Those songs are perfection.
Yeah, and I think with the Beatles and A Hard Day's Night are proto-power pop, you know? Definitely set up Cheap Trick and Nevermind and all the stuff that came. Yeah, it's a perfect. They're perfect albums. And this is kind of like a perfectly imperfect album, which is why
I like that.
Yeah, I prefer this album. Even though objectively I can hear With the Beatles and Hard Day's Night are better albums, I prefer this album. Like I would say, yeah, this is my fourth favorite Beatles album. Yeah, I only put Rubber Soul, Revolver, and White Album above this album. But it's imperfect, but there's moments. There's a dark majesty to especially these first three tracks, and that's a shout out to my buddy Richard Millett, who's going to be on a later episode that we do down the line. But my friend Richard Millett, he said these, you know, what was the exact quote? He actually just said it right now on Facebook, so I'm going to pull it up about these first three songs. Hold on, let me just pull this up. Yeah, he says the opening trio of songs is unbeatable. You could argue that this album is a little front-loaded. Now, I've grown to like the second half a lot more over the years, and I will argue in its defense, but out of the gate, yeah, it's the first three songs. Like, these first three songs are the big step forward for the Beatles and for John Lennon specifically as a songwriter, and they pack a punch, and we'll talk about each song as we get there. But yeah, No Reply, I feel if more people heard this song, It would be a bigger Beatles song. It's amazing, you know. It's dark. It's rich. It's what I'd call it, almost like dark rockabilly meets like kind of the Everly Brothers gone wrong. Like almost like if they walked into a David Lynch movie. You know?
Oh shit! I like that analogy.
Yeah, yeah. Like, you know, it's like Blue Velvet. You know, Blue Velvet. It's like it's this perfect like 50s-esque world, but beneath the surface there's like severed ears and fucked up shit going on. That's No Reply. No Reply is like, yeah, I grew up listening to Elvis and, you know, I like Buddy Holly and stuff, but there's something fucked up beneath the surface of John Lennon. There's something wrong. This is going to be the guy that does, you know, Happiness Is a Warm Gun and Cold Turkey down the line, you know? There's something wrong in Pleasantville, in Beatlemania. There's something
something creepy about the Beatles, man. There's something like just almost like kind of creepy like underneath with the Beatles, man. Some kind of darkness, you know, with them. Yeah. Which that's one of the big things I love about them so much.
So what do you think? Well, Eric, what do you think of No Reply now that we're talking about this dark stalker ballad? I mean, also one last thing I just want to say, the lyrics, this is a stalker song, by the way.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, this definitely like kicks off the tone of the album, because they're talking about how this is like kind of a dark album, and it really kicks off, because I mean, look at the last three albums. You had A Hard Day's Night, I Saw Her Standing There, and It Won't Be Long, just real upbeat, happy, like, you know, hey, we're the Beatles, you know, we're here to, you know, rock and roll, you know, type songs. And you get this one that's just like real dark. You know, it's the guy stalking his girlfriend, seeing that she's cheating on him, you know, and, you know, they're saying, you know, that chorus, like you mentioned, that was phenomenal, or him and Paul just like, I nearly died, you know, where they're screaming, just like, I nearly died, like, I nearly died, like, it's some dark stuff, like, this is not like, you know, Love Me Do, you know, it's somber. But the thing is, too, the music still is a little upbeat, like, at the beginning and whatnot. But, yeah, there's something dark about the song, and I love it, man. I think like I mentioned, this was, like, the last Beatles album that I finally got, where I had all of them finally. And it took me a while to listen to. I believe it was, you know, I was in middle school, because middle school is when I really went on my huge Beatles kick. And it was lunchtime, and so we're in the gym, you know, and I went to a private school. You know, during my middle school years, I was at a private school, and they were very anti, like, you know, my music. Like, I got in trouble so much for, you know, refusing to cut my hair, listening to my heavy metal and hard rock music, and I'd have an iPod with me that would sneak into school because they would not allow it because it didn't have Christian or approved music on it. So I'd sneak an iPod in, like, kind of listen to it at my lunch break. You know, I'd, like, slide the earbuds up through my hoodie so they couldn't see. And I would be listening to, you know, the Beatles and, like, or whatever music I was listening to. And it was a lunch break. And I'm like, man, I need to listen to this Beatles For Sale album. This is the only one I hadn't listened to yet. And, man, when this song kicked on, I was hooked. I was like, this is amazing. This just, you know, this amazing songwriting by Lennon McCartney. It was just so phenomenal. Like, just what a great way to kick off the album. And I love, like, how dark it is. And this is a perfect trifecta of, like, three songs to start an album. I put it up there with Never Say Die by Black Sabbath as, man, great 1-2-3 punch with three great songs to begin it.
Hey, so Charles, what do you think of No Reply?
Well, it's going to be hard to top what you guys already said, but just a quick couple little tidbits. I think it's like the little brother of I'll Be Back, which ended Hard Day's Night, and it's like in that same vein, and very good analysis, because it was Dick James who published the Beatles songs in the early days and kind of screwed them over in the long run, said this was the first complete song you ever wrote, which was originally written for Tommy Quickley, some artist that Brian Epstein managed. I've never heard if he did it or not. I'm not sure. But
I'd be interested in hearing that. I didn't know that.
I would too. I mean, what's unique about this is if you really look at all the Beatles EMI albums, this is the only downtrodden song to ever open a Beatles album.
Yes.
As far as EMI releases.
Yes.
The demo on Anthology 1, it points to the original idea, which was like a more up-tempo version of it, which would have been more in lockstep to that Beatles mania thing, and then they scrapped it, and they went to this version, and thankfully they shifted those gears. And we get this result, man, a magnificently gloomy track that I think better matches Stalking by far than something upbeat, which is what the protagonist in the song is doing, obviously, as you noted. I think this is one of the deeper, really goody-type tracks in their catalog that people don't talk about near enough. Fucking rule.
I agree.
Yeah, and man, and just again, there's another song, too, that is obviously going to make us talk about the harmonizing of Lennon McCartney.
Oh, yes, yes.
But, man, this chorus, just, you know, when Paul comes in with that scream in the, you know, during the chorus, and the way...
I nearly died!
Yeah, and the way it's blending with John, man, it's just like, they're almost, like, vocally the equivalent of, like K.K. Downing, Glenn Tipton. You know what I mean?
Like, well, I know the big thing, like, I watched I watched like several documentaries on the Beatles, and like one of them they mentioned something which I definitely think is very true. Like the big thing about their sound was it was like they took the music of like rock and roll, like Chuck Berry and Elvis, but they mixed it like some of that, like, you know, not really like maybe Motown, like
there's a little
strictly
bit,
Motown, but like those singing groups, like those girl groups, or like the 50s doo-wop guy groups, were like with the harmonizing. and they did that vocally, they did that, but add the rock and roll like of Chuck Berry and Elvis for the music, and it just gave them that kind of unique sound that no one else really had.
Yeah, and that's something that, you know, that's when they got more experimental. They did, you know, I think they brought it back a little bit with Abbey Road.
Yeah, Abbey Road was kind of going back to roots almost.
But between post Paperback Writer, which of course had amazing harmonies, it was very complicated. But I would say post that and before it, but pre Abbey Road, harmonizing wasn't, obviously there was still some harmonizing on Beatle albums, but it wasn't at the forefront.
Exactly, yes.
As it was during this period. Wouldn't you agree with that, Charles?
Yes.
Well, not to mention too, around that time too, in the later years, that's kind of when they started, you know, some songs didn't always have, you know, this guy on there. Some songs didn't always have that guy. Sometimes it was them working alone, this and that, you know, especially like on the White Album.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And but here they're still a band.
Yes.
Take the segue tag from Eddie there. I think the next song and a few more songs, which you brought up Paperback Writer, which I don't think the Beatles did that great live. Paul would do it later on his own live well, but the next few songs they did live quite a bit, and I thought they pulled them off rather expertly.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah, especially I think the third one when we get to that. but yeah, let's talk about I'm a Loser. Now, I'm a Loser is, I think, a song I immediately think of when I think of the Bob Dylan influence.
Oh, yes.
Yes, this is definitely post-Dylan, post-marijuana, This is John Let's Step Out. It's just like he was like the top songwriter. And then you know, I think George Harrison talked about like the prior year when they first heard the Free Will and Bob Dylan. And, you know, that was Bob Dylan's second album. And when he really emerged as a songwriter, you know, it was just loaded with Dylan classics. And the Beatles, from a songwriting standpoint, especially John, I think, because he was the one that felt, you know, he was, I guess you would say, the more personal songwriter of the Beatles. And he listened, and it was just like, us, you know, this fucking guy, this Jewish guy, American guy, you know, is kind of showing me up a bit. It's like, I got, and, you know, John was very competitive, you know, like he was with Paul. But, you know, throughout the career, you know, his career, he was also competitive with Dylan. And I think, if anything, I feel like Paul was competitive with Brian Wilson, and John was competitive with Bob Dylan.
That's a good point.
That's kind of what I feel is going on. I feel like McCartney's like sizing up Wilson, they're sizing each other up, and John's sizing up Dylan, and they're sizing each other up. And you know, and they influenced each other. You know, Dylan won Electric largely because of the Beatles. You know, so they were inspiring each other. But definitely, this song is John Lennon, even just from a sonic standpoint, like, you know, it's bringing in acoustic guitars, there's the harmonica. I mean, yeah, the Beatles did a little bit of that, you know, the rockabilly influence. They were both coming from a similar place, you know, both Dylan and John Lennon were big Elvis fans, you know, they were coming kind of from a similar place, but still, it felt like Dylan gave John Lennon kind of almost like permission, like, oh, I can get even folkier. I can do this. I can get even a little more rockabilly, a little more folkier, a little rootsier. And lyrically, obviously, just like No Reply, it's darker. It's a very dark song. It's I'm a Loser. You know,
yeah.
This is also a little proto grunge. I mean, think about all the you know, not just like Beck's Loser, but just like all those Creep songs. Like, there was a period where every band had a song called Creep.
Oh my god, there were so many artists with a song called Creep.
Yeah, you know, you had Stone Temple Pilots, you had Radiohead.
I love that song.
You even had TLC, even though it was in a different context.
Nirvana, yeah. Negative Creep.
Negative Creep, yeah, exactly, good one. So just in general, like the early 90s was a period where everyone was a loser or a creep, or, you know, and this is like, yeah, it's like, it's outwardly negative. It's overtly negative. It's like, No Reply is like a deceptive, dark love song. But I'm a Loser is not a love song at all. You know, this is just a full-fledged existential crisis song of someone singing about, John Lennon singing about how he thinks he's a loser. It's a self-hate song, you know, also very proto-Nirvana as well. And you know, even, you know, Dylan at this point wasn't writing as overtly personal. At that point, he was a little more political or sociological or satirical. And he would get more personal later on. But at this point, you know, this is a very groundbreaking song. That's another song that I think is undervalued and not looked at enough. You know, a lot of people will look at, like, Norwegian Wood, you know, or Nowhere Man, or a lot of the Rubber Soul songs. Of course, they are amazing and very progressive for their time period. But, you know, I'm a Loser, there was really not a lot of songs like this in 1964. You know, it's again a step in that direction. It's a step towards not just writing the typical boy meets girl song. And I'm thinking about this, I can't think of a Beatles song before this that doesn't involve, you know, whether it's negative or positive. I'm thinking about this. Isn't pretty much every Beatles song about boy meets girl kind of scenario?
Well,
before
be fair,
I'm a Loser?
Now, to be fair, like, if you look at all, like, the entire, like, you know, lyrics of this song, it is about, like, John just thinking he's a loser, being kind of self-dwelling. But there is, like, one or two lyrics, one of them being, like, you know, she was a girl in a million, my friend. I should have known
that's,
she would win
in
the end.
There is one love
I should have never crossed. So there is like one verse, like kind of him reminiscing about a girl. But then the rest of it could be interpreted as like anything, like him just dwelling on just himself in general, his life. But yeah, so there is technically something about, you know, a girl in it.
You're right. It is put in that kind of framework. So it's almost like it's like this whole album. He's got one foot in the past, one foot forward.
He's dipping his toes in the pool before he jumps in.
Yeah, like, I guess Help is the big jump, because I don't think Help does sing about a girl at all.
I think George's Don't Bother Me might have been...
No, that's him being a dick to some girl. That's him being like, yo, baby, step aside.
I think Help, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think Help lyrically sings about a girl. Does it? Isn't that all just self-crisis?
Yeah, Help is all self-crisis. That's like, I really do think that is the first one that has nothing to do with a girl. Because, Don't Bother Me is like him just being like, oh man, all these bitches. And like, if it was a rap song, I'd be like, oh, I got all these hoes on me. And like, they like, bitch, step aside.
Yeah, I agree with that interpretation. it's post-Help, too. That's another thing. Yeah. So, but you're right. Yeah, technically, I'm a Loser is probably, he's sad because of a girl. But it's definitely him stretching a little away from that. And the fact that the chorus is putting the focus on himself. Like, I'm a loser because this happened. That's where it's like, he's shifting. He's shifting a little bit away from the girl. He's shifting a little bit away from the bitches and a little more on himself.
Yeah, exactly.
Just a little bit. And then it, obviously, as John Lennon goes, he will get increasingly more and more about him. He'll be singing more and more about himself. His favorite topic by the time we get to the early 70s. You know. But definitely a step in that direction. And just, of course, as always during this period, you know, wonderful melody. Wonderful melody. I love it. It's one of their best songs, in my opinion. Another song like No Reply that, to me, should be like a big Beatles song. Like, it's an amazing song. What do you think of it, Eric?
Oh, it's fucking phenomenal. I love I'm a Loser. You know, it's one of those few songs with harmonica that I do like, because I'm not usually a big fan of harmonica, but if it, you know, sometimes when those rare occasions when it works, it works. It especially works in this song. It definitely is. It's Lennon, like, definitely going more towards the Dylan direction. He's definitely being influenced by Bob Dylan. It's all over this song. And, you know, yeah, it's very dark. You know, like I said, the first verse he's talking about a girl, but then the rest of the song, can really, it's just him dwelling. And, you know, like I said, around the time I listened to this album, you know, middle school, you're a young teenager, you're transitioning from a child to a teen to an adult, and, you know, you're going through a lot of shit, you know, you're starting to discover shit in the world. Life's starting to knock you around a little bit. You're starting to, you know, see the real world, how dark it can be, you know. So you go through some shit. And so this is a perfect song for that time, man. You know, when you're maybe kind of dwelling on yourself a little bit, you know, not thinking as highly of yourself. So it's kind of a perfect song to reflect, like, some of the things maybe I was going through at that time, you know. And it's a cool fucking song, man. I fucking love it. And again, it's another it's another dark one for the Beatles, man. This is not like your typical songs that they would have, you know. It's very, really dark.
Yeah. Charles, what do you think of I'm a Loser?
Well, definitely John in his Dylan period, man. You know, which the song definitely inspired by. And I've always thought one of the key differences in Lennon and McCartney's songs, usually, there are exceptions, but the writing approach by Lennon is direct / autobiographical, and McCartney had a coy, story-based, third-person type approach, and allegedly, this was definitely a way Lennon felt about himself, but he was also quoted as said, half the time he feels that way, the other half he felt like he was God Almighty.
Yeah, I'm the greatest, which he wrote.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Excellent vocals. One of my favorite harmonica songs that Eric touched on is I Like to Call Them. He was definitely in his harmonica days here, and Lennon played it. Another great Beatle deep cut that was also done live in those days, and it fucking delivered live as well. So, great track. Yeah.
I think John Lennon is a very underrated harmonica player. I always liked his harmonica melodies that he did in the early days.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
Mick Jagger said, you know, that was, he was happy to hear that they did the harmonica so much. And that's cool, man. Definitely.
All right. Now let's get into my favorite track on the album.
Yes.
It sounds like it might be Eric's too. I think a lot of people, if they listen to this album, this would be their favorite track. But it's not only my favorite track on the album, it's a top five Beatles song for me.
All right.
I don't know exactly where it falls in the top five, but it's not my favorite. My favorite's You Never Give Me Your Money. But it's in the top five. I know it's definitely a top five Beatles song. And it's my favorite Beatles song, definitely from, if you want to call this Beatlemania era, it's my favorite Beatles Mania era song. Although, like I said, I consider this a subtle transition album. But, yeah, Babies in Back, Babies in Black. So it's right there in the title. You know, Babies in Black. It's black. It's dark. Again, this is the trilogy. This is like the Beatles goth trilogy. The goth rockabilly trilogy of the first three songs on Beatles for Sale. Babies in Black, but what's a little different about Babies in Black is it is also kind of euphoric and beautiful sounding, and because it has, in my opinion, the single greatest Lennon McCartney harmony ever put on record. The whole song's the harmony. The whole song is Lennon McCartney singing the harmony. I consider this the purest Lennon McCartney song because this is a song that they both wrote together. And it sounds like it. Like, this sounds like, you know, by the time you got to the White Album, yeah, there were Paul songs and there were John songs. Like, occasionally, they worked together on a few things like Birthday and Happiness or Warm Gun. There were a few songs where there was some group effort, you know? But for the most part, that album is like a bunch of solo albums working, you know, with them helping each other. But they're essentially solo songs. But, you know, this album is from a period where they were still a band. Yeah, there were some songs that were a little more Lennon, like No Reply and I'm a Loser. And down the line, there'll be a few songs like I'll Follow the Sun and stuff that are definitely more McCartney. But overall, it's still a group effort at this point. There's still a songwriting team. And to me, Babies in Black is, it's like them straight down the middle. Just like, and I think that's why they're harmonizing it the whole way through. It sounds like, this sounds like a song of two men that are at their songwriting, at kind of reaching maybe one of many songwriting peaks together. You know, there's all these various peaks that they have, these little mini peaks that they're hitting some kind of stride together, and it sounds like a song the two guys write in a room together, you know, and sing it together. Like, it just has that vibe. Whether or not that's how this song was put together, I don't know, but it sounds that way. It sounds like, and whenever they did it live, this is another song that, you know, Charles just mentioned, like I'm a Loser. Babies in Black during this time period, 64 into 65. This is one of the songs they play, you know, at the big stadium show, you know, the next year, Shea Stadium. And it was amazing. It's one of the great live performances, in my opinion. You know, like, they pulled this off live. I love watching Lennon McCartney singing this song live together, using the same mic, you know? And it's amazing, and it's on the album, and the lyrics are, it's like, you know, it's a kind of basic 50s style boy meets girl kind of song, but brings in that darkness with the lyrics, especially that lyrics, and there's this bittersweet quality. I didn't realize at the time, I used to think, oh, Buddy Holly, and there's a huge Buddy Holly's, you know, Buddy Holly influence in the Beatles, and it's throughout this album, and there is a Buddy Holly song that they cover. But it was after that Everly Brothers died like a year or so ago that I kind of dived into the Everly Brothers a little bit, and I didn't realize when I listened to the Everly Brothers, which I was I wasn't too well versed in them, actually. When I listened to them, like, suddenly I understood early Beatles better. Like, oh, they're also influenced by the Everly Brothers. And, like, Babies in Black is, like, totally an Everly Brothers-style song, but a little darker. It's like the Everly Brothers got a little darker, like, went into that David Lynch world a little bit, you know? And the lyrics, it's amazing. Like, I could picture, like, Ally Sheedy's Basket Case character in The Breakfast Club, this being, like, her favorite Beatles album, and her listening to Babies in Black while smoking closed cigarettes in her room. You know? It's amazing. It's one of the greatest fucking songs of all time. And to me, it's a top-tier Beatles song. It's amazing. Oh, yeah. What do you think of it, Eric?
Oh, man, I love... This is... it's tied with another song. It's my favorite song, so I just cannot choose between the two songs. But it's tied for my favorite song on the album. I love Babies in Black, man. This song fucking rules. You're right. It's such a beautiful harmonization by John and Paul. And it does sound like they wrote this together. You know, because, yeah, there are a lot of songs. You know, they're all Lennon McCartney songs. But some of them, you know, it's really John's song. And then some of them, it's really, like, McCartney's song. But this one, it really sounds like these two guys collaborated and made, like, something. And it's fucking beautiful, but it's also dark, too. Again, it's just the Beatles going on with, like, this more darker stuff lyrically. For me, it's like, the song's, like, about, like, you know, a girl grieving and, like, just lamenting over this girl who's grieving the loss of maybe a loved one, you know. And so there's kind of a darkness about it. In a way, it is kind of like a love song, but, like, a dark love song, like, a dark meaning to it. And I know, too, this, like, I love the twangy guitar by George Harrison. I guess this was, like, one of the first times they rebelled against George Martin and did their own thing. And, you know, kind of went against what he said, because I guess George Martin didn't really like the twangy guitar sound that they wanted. And they kind of just, you know, they kind of forced it on the album. And it works, though. Like, thank God they disobeyed George Martin this one time, because it's phenomenal. The twangy guitar is amazing.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was pretty much finished.
I was gonna say, I'm glad you brought up George Harrison's guitar, because I was thinking while
it's beautiful.
Oh shit, I forgot about George Harrison's guitar, because it's my guitar solo on the album.
Yes,
amazing. I didn't know that story you just told me. So
yeah, I read about it. I was doing a little bit of research, but yeah, I guess George Martin didn't want, like, that kind of twangy sounding guitar, and it was kind of like I said, it was one of the first times the Beatles said, like, no, we're doing this. I mean, we don't care what you say, like, we're doing this.
Right on, because they were more rock and roll. He didn't quite get the probably the roughness to it, and
yeah.
It brings a little bit of, like, the Sun Studio kind of vibe to it. It's so, like, Scotty Moore esque. I love the guitar line. That's why I said I think George Harrison's a very underrated lead guitarist, especially when he does the rootsier stuff. And it's all part of this, you know, beautiful. It's almost like the song's like it's just like a it's like almost like a haiku. It's just this perfect poem of a song. It's beautiful, and it does a thing where it feels like it's just revolving, like it begins, ends, and wraps back into itself. It's amazing. Charles, come on. You got to gush over this song as well, right?
Another uniquely sophisticated song here. Done in waltz 3/4 time, which was something that set them apart from any of their contemporaries. And a lot of their contemporaries also said, oh, it's a fucking waltz. And they're like, yeah, we like it. It's cool. That's what set them apart. Was literally sang by John and Paul on one mic in the studio.
Wow.
Which is just a great touch. It's a I think it's a great song for those that may be lesser familiar with Beatles work to hear the brilliance of Lennon and McCartney and their harmonies, and best song in the fucking album by far.
Right on.
Yeah.
So, Babies in Black rules. And it translated live great as well. So, tremendous.
Awesome. Love it. So glad that we're all on the same page with this one. Next one. Okay. Now, yes, this album, I agree with my friend Richard. It starts off the best, in my opinion. It sounds like Eric's got one other that we didn't get to. But in my opinion, the best three songs are the first three songs. Now, I still love this whole album. Even the covers we're going to get to. And we'll talk about the covers when we're going to talk about them right now because we're getting the first one. All right. This is generally one of the things I think that gives this album a bad rap is I think a lot of people, I've read some critics and some people say they feel this album's regressive because, like A Hard Day's Night, there was no covers. And so to then to suddenly start doing covers again, it felt kind of like a step backwards. Like, we're going back to With the Beatles and Please Please Me where there's covers. But I argue that I don't feel like, yeah, they were a little spent after touring, and that is a reason why half the songs are covers. But I would argue that only if the idea of covers is regressive is it regressive, if you know what I mean. Like, yeah, if the idea that you don't write every song is a regressive idea, I don't buy into that necessarily.
It's kind of like how people feel at Diver Down by Van Halen.
That's actually
still, I consider that my favorite Van Halen album at the moment.
It's like, even I prefer Fair Warning, but I don't consider Diver Down a step back because from a sonic standpoint, it's definitely a bridge forward to 1984, you know, even on the covers, especially on some of the covers, like they're bringing in the synthesizers more, it's definitely getting you to 1984, which, even if that's not my favorite of the Dave era albums, obviously that's like, you know, a big hit album, and obviously it's great, like I think all David Lee Roth is. But what I'm getting at, there is a kind of evolutionary, you know, it's moving forward in the direction that Eddie wants to go into. And Dave, they both kind of, it's also kind of pushing Dave into the more Vegas-y, you know, stuff he would do in his solo career. So Diver Down is moving them forward, even though half of it's covers. That's just like this album, in my opinion. Like, even though, I mean, A, listen to, just like Diver Down, listen to the original songs. The original songs are definitely a step forward, and they all kick ass. But the covers, I feel the covers are on another level, especially this one. I'm going to make a bold statement now. I think Rock and Roll Music by the Beatles is the greatest Chuck Berry cover I've ever heard. I've never heard a Chuck Berry cover this strong. The Rolling Stones were great at covering Chuck Berry. And before this album, I thought they did a better job. I never really cared. We talked about this in that lost episode. None of us, if I recall, were impressed with George Harrison's take on Roll Over Beethoven. We thought it was one of the weaker tracks. Yeah. Well, Rock and Roll Music, I don't think that. I think the level of sophistication they bring to it, the music, there's more. If you listen to the original Chuck Berry version, and no disrespect to Chuck Berry, I love Chuck Berry, and I love the original version. This is better. I think this is an evolution. I think they kind of did to this song kind of what Led Zeppelin did with a lot of those blues songs later. They add a layer of sophistication to the music. There's more going on. There's the piano. John's singing is off the hook. Some of his best vocals. This is a level of expertise that they did not, their covers were not this, there were a few that were close, like I think we all loved Please Mr. Postman.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, there were a few with the Beatles that were, you know, pretty special. But to me, this is like, this is the next level. I think this is like a total class act. To me, when I think of rock and roll music, this is the definitive version. I think this is even more definitive version than the Chuck Berry version. I think from a production standpoint, I think from a musician standpoint, I think John Lennon's vocals, and it comes just where you want it. Like after the gloomy first three songs, you know, like, yeah, now let's have some fun. It's a rock and roll album, you know? And I think it's a masterful cover. And yeah, I don't see it as a step backwards. I think it's a step forward on a lot of ways. And I don't think the Beatles would have been capable. If you compared like how they sound on Please Please Me, they wouldn't have been able to make this song sound this good, you know, in my opinion. So what do you think? Let's mix it up a little bit. Charles, what do you think of rock and roll music?
Well, man, the show just keeps continuing. I mean, this album's ruled so far, man. And you get that Chuck Berry cover, which I prefer, I'm assuming like you, over the Berry original.
Yeah.
You just said it. John, I mean, we get vocal hiccups, you know, all kinds of different things here. Lennon owns this song. It was a staple of the Beatles live sets, you know, from 1959 to 66. My most fascinating period of the Beatles is actually the Hamburg days. I wish I could have, if I had a time machine, I would go to the Reeper Bond and check them out when they were just getting going. I mean, this owns the Berry cover, Roll Over Beethoven, on With the Beatles. And oh, yeah. This was recorded in one take.
Wow, I did not know that.
Yeah, this is one you crank the fucker up, man. I don't think we've had a bad track to this point on the album.
Awesome, nice. Eric, what do you think of rock and roll music?
So, it's a good song, good cover, but not personally one of my favorites on the album. I think it's just maybe placement because of just where it's placed. You know, you have three great original songs that are really dark in tone, and then you just have this real upbeat, like, you know, rockabilly kind of rock and roll song. I think it just kind of throws me off, I guess. Maybe that's probably why I'm not as big of a fan of it. Not a bad song, but definitely, like, it's probably my least favorite on the album. It's definitely one, like, I'm not gonna, if I have someone listen to the album, I'm not gonna be like, oh, you gotta listen to rock and roll music. You know, it's just not a personal favorite of mine. It's just definitely, like, I think it's just such a shock after, like, the three songs we just heard. It just sounds out of place for me.
Yeah, well, maybe it would work better if they switched this 8 days a week, maybe, for you. It'd make rock and roll music track opening. It could work. But, yeah, you can't win them all. But you don't hate it, so that's good. how do you compare it to the original, the Chuck Berry one?
I will say I agree with you guys that this is better than the Chuck Berry version. I love me some Chuck Berry, but I do agree that their version is better than the Chuck Berry version. I think it's just placement on the album. It's just too much of a shock.
Okay, fair enough. Now we're moving to the kind of for really the only song on this album that I would describe as full-fledged McCartney-esque. you know, it's like, because, you know, McCartney, at this point, it's John's band primarily. He's the leader, or there's, like, you know, McCartney helping Lennon with Lennon's songs. But this sounds like pure McCartney. This sounds like a song McCartney probably wrote himself. Mm-hmm. And he sings it, and it's I'll Follow the Sun. Beautiful song. Beautiful little ditty. Only 1 minute and 49 seconds long. And I think that's part of its... For me, that's like one of my favorite things about it. Like, I don't mean this as a diss, that the fact that it's short's good. I just mean that there's something, it's almost like a little whisper of a memory that you think about and then it's gone. Or like dapple sunlight, like, you know, that's fading at dusk, you know, and there's that one little moment where it hits the trees just right and then it's gone, you know? And he captures that with this song, the mood, the music, McCartney's, you know, beautiful, bittersweet vocal delivery. Now, this is not the statement that Yesterday would be, obviously, on the next album, but this is like the step in that direction. You know, this is what I mean about the transition. I'll Follow the Sun sounds like it's like the song you write on an album before you write Yesterday, you know? It's like leading you to that. And, you know, and Here, There, and Everywhere, and all these, you know, wonderful songs that he would write, these bittersweet love songs. And it's beautiful. It's another one of my favorite songs on this album. It's a beautiful song. Yeah, but I wouldn't say it's my favorite. I definitely would put the first three ahead of it, but it's a beautiful song, and it's definitely, goddamn, I love this album. Eric, what do you think of I'll Follow the Sun?
Oh, it's fucking beautiful, man. Just a real pretty, whimsical little McCartney ballad, man, which he was very well known for. He wrote, like, the real whimsical, kind of real sweet, like, soft songs like this. And I love it. It's beautiful. And I guess he had had, I guess it's like a song he had for a while that like just they didn't use for so long because it really didn't fit in with everything else they were doing. And so I guess this one sat on the back burner for a little bit until they finally put on this album. And God, it's just, it's amazing. It's a nice little break because you kind of got like, you know, like, not, I mean, this shit isn't like heavy metal, but I mean like, you know, like some heavier songs, like upbeat songs, and you kind of have a nice pretty little ballad. After like, you know, four like pretty, you know, rock and roll songs. And I love it. I love like lyrically, it's kind of like about, you know, leaving that person that's just, you know, leaving someone that, you know, you don't really want to leave because it's tough, but like they're a person that's kind of dragging you down, you know, and really not helping out in life. And you got to just leave that person to better your life. And it may be a difficult decision, but, you know, it's, you know, ultimately for the better. And I think it's really beautiful, man. It's just real positive about, you know, like, you know, tomorrow may rain, so I'll follow the sun. And just like, you know, life can be bringing you down, but you're just going to choose to stay positive and take the road that's going to lead you to a better day, you know. I think it's a beautiful song and just beautiful. Like, lyrically, I love the message. It's beautiful.
Right on. Charles, what do you think of I'll Follow the Sun?
Well, man, we finally get Paul on the record with this rather delicate ballad that amazingly had its root in his family home at age 16 while convalescing from the flu.
Wow.
He wrote this at 16, and it just blows my mind that this came from a 16-year-old's mind. As much as I really dig Lennon, he's my favorite Beatle in the Beatles. This song is pure McCartney brilliance, and his vocals are absolutely brilliant on the track. It's one of my favorite Beatles ballads, and another great deep track. This album is nothing but deep tracks, it seems.
Right on. Okay, now this, I would say, is probably the most debated, and well, I wouldn't even say debated, the most the most outrightly disdained Beatles song from their early days. If I'm thinking about what's the least popular Beatles song, it's probably all those George Harrison Indian songs that, you know, that's my guess. Like Without You especially, I feel like if I've heard people taking shots at Beatles songs, that's probably the one I've heard the most. Hey, I don't love it as much as you, Eric, but I don't hate Within You Without You either, you know.
I love that song. I fucking love it.
I just think it's a little too long, but I don't have a problem with it. And I love You Too. I think that's a great
song. Oh, that song fucking kicks ass. I love that damn song.
But, you know, but I get that. This is the thing. Even though I don't share the anti-George Harrison Indian music sentiment, I understand it because it's a real simple sentiment. It's like, if you don't like Indian music, yeah, you're going to hate that song. It's like a different kind of music. It's not rock and roll, you know? It's a different kind. It's not even like chamber pop, you know? It's like a total... It's just a totally different genre of music. So yeah, if you're not into that, I get why some rock fans, like the same reason why I get why some rock fans don't like Yoko Ono or Revolution 9. Like, yeah, I get it. You're not into avant-garde shit. This song, however, even though, don't get me wrong, I get why it's not like a go-to Beatles song. I get why people don't like it as much as a lot of other songs. But I never understood the hate Mr. Moonlight gets. I just don't get it. So I'm gonna ask you guys if you understood it. I mean, I get why people wouldn't say, hey, yeah, listen to Mr. Moonlight, one of the best Beatles songs. But I don't get why people get so venomous with the song. Like, people really hate the song. Oh. And it has a lot of people shitting on it, and they go, oh, it's such a horrible song. And I really like it. I think it's one of the stronger covers on the album. And, I mean, I love Lennon's vocal in the very beginning when he screams Mr. Moonlight, when he does that a cappella thing in the beginning. Amazing. Amazing vocal.
I get chills, man.
Yeah, I love the sound of the guitars. The harmony's a little different for them, which I like. It's a little different for kind of Lennon McCartney harmony. It has that amazing organ solo in the middle that we were talking about, how this is a subtle progression, this album, musically. Well, there you go. You got a little organ there. I think it's a wonderful cover. I think it's another musical step forward for the band. I think I'm looking at this. Yeah, this is actually my second favorite cover, if we're talking about the covers on the album. All the original songs I would put above this, but it's my second favorite cover after rock and roll music, and I don't get the hate. I think it's a delightful 50s style rock and roll ballad cover, and I think they do an amazing job, and it has amazing singing, amazing harmonies, and I love that organ solo. So I just don't get it. So Eric, do you get it? Do you get why people hate this song?
I just don't get the hate for the song. Everyone shits on the song, and I love it, man. It's fucking beautiful. This is my favorite cover on the album. It's just, I love it, man. The way John just screams Mr. Moonlight at the beginning, like, you know, oh, it's just infectious. I love it lyrically, man. It's a, like, you know, talking about, like, one night there's probably, like, a full moon and met the girl of his dreams and had just a one crazy, like, wild, fun night, you know, and just, yeah, I can relate to that, you know. Maybe that's why I like it, because it makes me sentimental when I hear the lyrics, because it just reminds me of, like, when you're young and, like, maybe you just have those nights where you're hanging out with your buddies and, like, just, you know, you don't even plan it. You just go hang out with your buddies and you have the best night of your life, or, you know, go out one night and you meet this amazing girl who shows you a good time, or, you know, just, like, all these great experiences you have in life when you're young and you don't plan it. It just happens. You just have those nights and how you just long for those days again, you know, like, and maybe you go somewhere. You go to this, like, your friends take you somewhere, like, hey, we're going here to this spot. We're going to this park to meet up with some friends. And you go there and you have the best night of your fucking life. And then, like, you know, when it's all over, all you do is reminisce about, man, I want to go to that park again and just have another night like that. I want to have, like, another fun night, you know, just those nights where everything goes right and you just have the best time of your life, man. And it's just like, I think that's why I like it so much. Because lyrically, that's what it makes me think of. It reminds me of those nights. You go somewhere, like, you see the moonlight, and, like, you have the best night of your life, you know, and being young and having fun. That's why I love it. And it's a beautiful song, and it's, like, it's just, like, one of those kind of old 50s-sounding songs, which I love. I love old 50s music, you know, so I love this damn song. I don't get why people fucking are so venomous with this song. It's just, it's beautiful.
Right on. This is why we got a podcast together. Right?
Yeah, this is why we have
it's the moonlight.
Yeah, hell yeah. Yeah.
It also, it's interesting, I didn't even think about this until now. I'm looking at this. It follows I'll Follow the Sun. So you got the sun and then the moonlight, you know?
That is interesting. I do like that. Yeah. You know what? The first song he's talking about leaving behind someone that's kind of leaving a bad relationship with some girl that's dragging him down, and, like, he's like, man, I'm, you know, life may be hard, but I'm going to follow the sun to a better day. And then Mr. Moonlight's like, oh, man, you just have the best day of your life, man. You just want to keep having those days like that.
Yeah, it's nice. Okay, well, let's find out, Charles, if he's a Mr. Moonlight hater or Mr. Moonlight, lover, or somewhere in the middle. Where are you, Charles?
Well, I think I'm going to probably be the bad guy now, because I not only get all the venom for it, I'll probably lead the charge, as this is the worst fucking song the Beatles have ever done on any album.
Oh, wow. Wow. Okay, well, this is perfect.
Yeah.
Okay, this is perfect, because now you could explain to us two guys that don't get it. So, yeah,
oh my God,
try to put the words, Charles, why you people hate this song so much.
So horrible, but it's pretty simple why I hate it, because I didn't hear, I heard Anthology 1 before I heard the album, and that version on Anthology 1 isn't too great either. It's a shit sandwich as well, but they also have Leave My Kitten Alone, which was done at the same time, and it's vastly superior by far. It fucking rocks. And, I mean, if you're going to put a cover, I mean, why put this shit sandwich when you could put a fucking great rockin' tune? If people don't believe me, go listen to Anthology 1. I don't like the organ. I get the whole, they're moving forward, but I hate this fucking song. I think it's the worst Beatles song, worse than Octopus's Garden, worse, I don't like Only a Northern Song. I think that's terrible.
Oh, I love that song.
I love that song.
Yeah.
Thankfully, this is a cover, by the way. As far as, you know, I've always hated this fucking song. It's terrible. Beyond, I get the point of his scream in the beginning. And then it just goes downhill.
Okay. So at least you like the scream in the beginning. You just don't like when the song actually happens.
You have at least one positive to take away from it.
Yeah. It's my least favorite ever. But wow. I'm judging it against Leave My Kitten Alone, which, you know, if nobody's ever heard that, check it out. I guess it didn't. My guess is this song matched the theme of the album better than Leave My Kitten Alone.
And they want maybe some diversity, different styles, you know. Maybe.
But it actually rocks.
Well, the next song is like a rocker. Kansas City, Hey, 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 a cover.
Hey, 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 hey.
This is something Little Richard used to do this song a lot. It's a Lieber and Stroller, you know, who wrote a lot of Elvis's big hits, written song. Now, this is not as... I definitely prefer the Little Richard version. Now, McCartney, yeah, he's doing his Little Richard thing. I think he's done it better on certain other songs, including She's a Woman, which was the coinciding single during this period, which is a great song.
Love it.
An original, and I think McCartney's singing stronger. It's all right. If I had to pick a least favorite on this album, I would say it was this song. I would say it's Kansas City's Hey, Hey, Hey. It's not bad. I like it. I don't think there's a bad song on this album. It's solid. But this is a filler track. I think this could have been on Please Please Me. Like, I don't hear a major step forward. I mean, maybe McCartney's singing a little bit, but I don't know. It's all right. It's serviceable. It feels like this was probably just some old standard that they used to play at the Star Club, and they needed to fill an album, and they dusted this one off. That's kind of what it sounds like to me. It's not bad. It's fine to kind of wrap up the first side with it. I don't have a problem with it, but if I had to pick a least favorite, this is my least favorite. But it's, you know, it's all right rocker. It's an all right cover. It does its job. What do you think, Eric?
I love this one, man. This is I like it a lot better than rock and roll music. This one's great. I think what sells it for me is Paul's singing. Paul just, you know, he's screaming his ass off on this one, man. I love it. I love his vocals. This is just, it's a fun song. I like it, man. Real fun. You know, after like two kind of more, you know, mellower songs, you want to get back into that rock and roll, man, and this is the perfect song to do it for. I guess you could even say like some, you know, prehistoric gang vocals in a way. Yeah, I mean, it is like prehistoric, like, you know, early gang vocals. So, man, the Beatles really revolutionized a lot of shit, you know? I love it, man. I love Kansas City. Hey, 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 man. Paul's vocals on here just shine.
Right on. Okay, Charles, what do you think of this?
Well, it's another one-take song. Paul and Full Little Richard Glory. It's actually a cover of the Little Richard version, which is a medley of two songs. And I enjoy it, but unfortunately, the song is cut off way too soon. Kind of like how... Gotta Get You Into My Life was done on Revolver. I thought they cut that off too soon in the edit, too. It loses the full gusto, and it don't believe that. I mean, there's versions, live versions on Live at the BBC and Anthology 1. You'll get what I mean. McCartney, though, he could sing songs like this in his sleep. And quite honestly, to me, Paul is that X factor in this band, is I don't think the other bands of the day could quite do these type of songs like he could, just because of him. A good version, but there are better ones out there, though.
Okay, let's flip this over, and here we're getting to the, I guess you say, if there was one hit from this album.
Yes. This is the big hit.
Yeah, this is the big hit. This is the one song that most people would know. Casual fans would know this song. 8 days a week. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think Charles would know this. This was originally going to be the title song for the kind of, you know, title but not title song for the movie that ended up being Help. Because originally it was called Eight Arms to Hold You.
Correct.
Yeah, so this was kind of good. It's a thing we like, Eric, you know, when we say something's like a title song without being a title song. Yeah, so 8 days a week was going to be kind of like that. Like, it referenced eight, you know, and this was going to be like kind of the lead-off song for the album Eight Arms to Hold You. But somewhere, because this is, you know, relatively, you know, all these albums are recorded like months apart, you know. This period's moving really fast. So they were already, like, kind of planning what would become Help, their next movie. and writing songs, and this was at that early stage. Obviously, there was a certain point where the Beatles decided to go with Help instead, and it may be at the songwriting stage, but this was already in the can, so this was probably like a when they slapped together this album, and this was, you know, one of they decided to throw this on, they decided to release this, you know, instead here. And it was a single, I believe. Normally they didn't release singles from albums, but if I do believe this was a single. I'm looking at this. Yeah. So this was one of the rare cases where they would do that. I mean, a lot of the Beatlemania albums had songs that just stations would grab, whether or not they were even officially released as singles, but this was officially a single. And yeah, I mean, this I it's a little bit, there's a little progression here, especially in the, I would say, the intro guitar work and the outro guitar work, where it kind of does that bookend with the guitars that are, I would say, almost a little vaguely psychedelic, not like overtly by any means, but has a little bit of that mid-60s Birds quality, you know, the band The Birds.
Oh, yeah, and the intro, definitely.
Yeah, the ding, the ding, 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 ding. There's something there that, again, feels like that's not something they would have musically have done on their first two albums. So there's a little bit of that. But the middle section, like the main part of the song, that's just like pure height of Beatlemania. Like that melody could have been on A Hard Day's Night or with the Beatles, and which means it's amazing. Which means it's an amazing melody, you know. It's just pure ear candy, in the way that a lot of songs on with the Beatles and Hard Day's Night are pure ear candy. I would say it's one of my favorites on the album. It's like a mid-tier song for me, but it's undeniable to me. I know John Lennon would piss all over the song years later. It's like one of the songs he said he didn't like.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But I disagree, obviously, respectfully, John Lennon, like I did with a lot of his opinions about certain Beatles songs. But yeah, it's pure ear candy. It's obvious why it was a single. And I think it's a good opening track for the second side, too. I think it's a great song. And it's, you know, it's fucking Beatles. It's 8 days a week. What do you think of Eric?
Oh my god, this is the other song, man. This is tied with Babies in Black as my favorite song on the album. It's just, it's so good. This is like, it's the perfect song. I this is like in my top five Beatles songs of all time. I just love everything about this song. It's so catchy. It's a fun song to sing along to. Like, I remember me and my friend one time, me and my buddies are drunk, and we pulled up to a White Castle drive-thru. And we're trying to sing this song, and my friend kept fucking up. Like, he kept coming in too early because we're trying to harmonize, and he just kept fucking up and coming in too early and messing it up. But I love this song, man. It's just so fun. It's so catchy. I mean, this shit's amazing. It's like a perfect song. I wish I could write a song as perfect as this. And you know, and like you said, yeah, this is one of the ones John Lennon just shit on. You know, he called it lousy, and it's like, I just don't know how you could listen to a song like this and think it's lousy. And it's just, this is such a song to be proud of that you wrote. It's so perfect. And I love too, like the video that they have on YouTube where it's like them performing this, and it's all the footage of them at Shea Stadium, you know, that legendary Shea Stadium show. And just, you know, it's so cool seeing the Beatles on top of the world, man, performing, kicking ass. And you see all these girls fainting and pissing themselves and freaking out over the Beatles, man. And it's like, yeah, like fucking Beatles just, yeah, they fucking rule, man. This just, it's a perfect song, man. I love 8 days a week. Fun song to sing. You know, I absolutely love this. It's a perfect song, in my opinion. I'd put this in my top 10 favorite songs of all time, even. So I love it. I think very highly of this song. It's great.
Nice. I had a feeling this was the song that was
tied with Babies. It's so good. It's so good.
Awesome. So what do you think of 8 days a week, Charles?
It's unfortunately it's one of my lesser favorite number one singles by the Beatles, but that doesn't mean it sucks by any stretch of the imagination. You know, like if Herman and the Hermits did this, it'd be the greatest song they ever did. You know, usually when I'm critical, to include Mr. Moonlight, I'm balancing it against other Beatles stuff I love. I'm not saying against, you know, like, I don't know, Counting or some kind of
loving spoonful, or yeah,
right. Like I mean, that, yeah. It's just
wait.
I think it does seem a little pedestrian for them, but it went number one. So I mean, what the fuck do I know, man? I mean, it's also fun to play on the guitar. It's really a really fun song to play on the guitar. Just another pedestrian number one single of 27 number one singles by the greatest band.
They were knocking them out like it was nothing.
Right.
Right. Wait,
I do rank it lower on their top number one singles, but I still think it's a fantastic song. So.
Right. Wait, was Loving Spoonful, is that the band that did that song, Summer in the City?
No, that they did
Hooked on a Feeling.
No, I think it's magic. It's I think it's a good be magic. What's the song?
Summer to Sea. Like, I'm just gonna bring this up because we're probably never gonna mention the band that did that song on this podcast again. That song scared the shit out of me as a kid. I don't know why, but man, Summer to Sea. When I hear that ding 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 ding,
yeah. No, that's I kinda like that song.
That song, scared me as a kid.
I'll take it back. Okay, I was a little hard on the Loving Spoonful. Because they did do Summer in the City, and I knew that song.
That's a good song. It's a good song. But, man, when I was a little kid, for whatever reason, man, that song scared the shit out. I was terrified of that song. It creeped me out.
That's a cool song. Yeah, it is.
It's a good song. I love it. I love it now. But, man, when I was a kid, I was terrified of that song.
I was like that about the Beatles and... anything remotely connected to Yellow Submarine freaked the shit out.
Yeah, there's some creepy, like we mentioned in the Sgt. Pepper's episode, there's some kind of creepy about the Beatles.
Oh, yeah, with the mustaches and all that. Sgt. Pepper, that all scared me as a kid. But,
the ending of that album.
Well, hippies scared me. Hippies scared me.
Yeah, hippies are fucking weird, man. They're so dirty and weird.
This is even before I knew about Manson, but I had a sense. My little child blind had a sense of some Manson shit was behind this.
This fight is so ominous. I mean, that's a really ominous
song. There's an ominous undercurrent, of course. Yeah. Summer in the City is a good song, so I was a little hard. Maybe I'll give the Loving Spoonful a shot. The problem is, I hate that fucking song, their biggest song, Do You Believe in Magic?
Everyone has to cover that goddamn song, too.
It's total fucking dork rock. I hate that fucking song. It's up there for like Sweet Caroline and Brown Eyed Girl.
I can't stand Sweet Caroline. I hate the bump, bump, bump part that white people
do. Oh, yeah.
It's like, you know, when people make fun of white people and...
Yeah.
You know, I'm white, for those of you that don't, know me personally. But, you know, when people make fun of white people and they bring up Sweet Caroline, it's one of those things where I'm like, yeah, I get it.
Yeah. Only no non-white person ever created a song that lame. But anyway, but now back to a band that never released shit songs like that. Even Mr. Moonlight, in Charles' opinion, would probably be better than Do You Believe in Magic. I would hope. Anyway, but now, hey, we're back to covers again. Hey, Words of Love, a Buddy Holly cover. Big influence. I mentioned Buddy Holly earlier. Okay, not one of the stronger tracks. A decent cover. But I like it. I like it a little bit better in Kansas City. It's all right. The harmonies, you get like a three-way harmony here for Lennon McCartney and Harrison, which is kind of nice. I prefer the original. I'm a big Buddy Holly fan. And... yeah, I don't think this is as good as the original, but it's decent. You know, it's all right. You know, I don't skip it. You know, I keep listening to it. There's another two covers coming up that I think are stronger, but it's all right. What do you think, Charles, of Words of Love?
Words of Love. The Buddy Holly cover. It was definitely done in the Cavern days and. Interestingly, originally it featured only George and John on vocals, but George is in the background of this, but it's definitely Paul and John in the front, and I think this could have been some of Harrison's best guitar work on the record.
It is good guitar work, I should say.
It's a fantastic cover. There's a great version that was done live at the BBC too, as well, if people wanted to check that out. I enjoy this cover quite a bit.
All right, nice. What do you think, Eric?
Oh, amazing. I fucking love this one. And it was funny, when I first heard this album, I knew some Buddy Holly songs, so I wasn't as familiar with him. And when I first heard this, I thought, wow, this sounds like Buddy Holly. Later, I went on to find out that it was a Buddy Holly cover, and it's amazing. I love the fuck out of the song. I actually have a song that I wrote that's almost like I kind of, you know, it's very, my, the melody line's very similar to this song. You know, and I love Buddy Holly, man. I really do love him. I'm a big fan. And the Beatles really knocked it out of the park with this cover, and it's a great song. I love it. Great guitar work by George, like Charles said, man. That's probably some of his best guitar playing on the album. I love it, man. I really, really love it. It's a great cover. It's probably, this is probably my favorite cover on the album. You know, I love Mr. Moonlight for sentimental reasons, but as far as like an actual song, you take away the sentimental reasoning, this would be my favorite cover on the album, definitely.
All right. Here's another cover. Now, me, I'm a big fan of Honey Don't, Carl Perkins cover. There's two Carl Perkins covers, interestingly, each given to a Beatle that only gets one song to sing on this album. Vocals. Normally, Harrison would get two. Maybe not this stage, I guess. That would become a norm starting with, guess Help or Rubber Soul? What is it?
Help.
Yeah, starting with Help, he gets two songs an album. Three on Revolver, actually. But here he was just...
Technically.
Yeah. What do you mean, technically? He has three songs on Revolver.
Well, no, because there's the rumor going around that Taxman was really written by John, and I'm not... You know, I kind of don't really know what to believe with that.
Well, he's at the very least, he's singing lead. I'm just talking singing. He didn't write the song.
Oh, okay. I hear what you're saying.
Yeah. So, so he gets Harrison and Starr both get a Carl Perkins song to sing on this side of the album. I think I would put this above the original. I like Carl Perkins, but not as much as Buddy Holly, but I like Carl Perkins. But I think this is an improvement because I think Ringo, in addition to being an underrated drummer, I think Ringo is very underrated when it comes to country singing. I think he's very good at rockabilly and country singing. He did
I agree.
He did a wonderful country album in the early 70s I really love, called Boo Coops of Blue. And, you know, of course, he would sing Act Naturally on the next album. And, yeah, Don't Pass Me By kind of has a country kind of feel to it. I think he's a really good country singer. He has a really nice country croon. And I think this song makes really good use to it. And I think it's the first time. I'm thinking of the songs Ringo sang before this. Maybe a little bit Matchbox, which was on the Long Tall Sally EP, recorded like a few months before this. And he did a great version of that, too. I love his Matchbox. Ringo had a really great voice for the Carl Perkins songs. And I love it. I think it's a great cover. This is probably my second favorite cover after rock and roll music, so... I'm a big fan of it. What do you think, Charles?
Well, the lads must have felt bad about not having a Ringo sung song on the previous Hard Day's Night LP, which is the only one where he doesn't sing a song. This was another cover that was done differently, as Lennon used to take the lead vocals. There's a version on Live at the BBC. But the Ringo Army, man, they must have been raging. So this was given to him. Well, I do think Ringo struggled a few times. It doesn't really matter, man. You get Ringo telling George to rock on.
I love that.
He actually had some really cool improvisations there. It's not perfect, but it's fun. And I'm glad Ringo got into this one here. I thought, you know, for its little imperfections, it was still really, really, really kick-ass.
Okay, cool. And again, I forgot to mention George Harrison's guitar, so I'm glad you did. Amazing guitar work again. I think Harrison's just really spot on with these 50s-style rockabilly guitar lines, you know? He really has a great feel for it. What do you think, Eric, of Honey Don't?
I love Honey Don't, man. Ringo sings his ass off on this one, and I love his voice. You know, he has, like, not a great singing voice technically, but it works. It has a charm to it that I just absolutely love. And, man, he's got some soul on it. His voice has some fucking soul in it, you know, on this song. It's amazing. Like, even, too, like, I think there's a point in the song where his voice cracks, but it works. It sounds so amazing, and I love it, man. Great little... R&B-ish kind of sounding song. I mean, I get like an R&B kind of vibe from it. Fucking love Honey Don't, you know, and Ringo's, you know, vocally, Ringo's kind of like the Ace Frehley of the group. The only thing is they use him sparingly. They use him just the right amount. Whereas Ace Frehley, sometimes on Kiss albums, they use him a little too much, right? It's like, okay, that's enough of his voice for now.
Oh, well, hey, you're talking about Dynasty and Unmasked. There's 2 hours.
Yeah. I just had to bring up Ace Frehley just so I could get some Kiss viewers on this episode. I fucking love the fuck out Honey Don't. Great fucking song.
All right, now we're back to Lennon McCartney original. Every Little Thing. I would say we're getting to probably the three of the least known Lennon McCartney songs ever. Like this row of songs that we're getting to.
Unfortunately.
And I agree, unfortunately. Yes, not as strong as the first three by any means. It's not that, you know, I mean, God, No Reply, I'm a Loser, Babies in Black. That's a tough trio to match. And no, I don't think this trio we're getting to matches that. But still damn good. Very, very underrated collection of songs we're about to hit right now. Every Little Thing. I love this song. I think it's a great song. It's a great, very McCartney-esque, but, you know, it's Lennon McCartney. They both do vocals on it. And I love the little, it has this sweep to the chorus, if you know what I mean. Like, it's almost a little, it's not like full-out Phil Spector, but it has a little bit of that. You mentioned the R&B. I think there's a little bit of that in this, like a little bit of that girl group Phil Spector-esque quality. This also sounds like when I said McCartney was like paying attention to like Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys. This has a little bit of a Beach Boys little vibe to it, I think. And I think it's a great production. I think the vocals are strong. I know that McCartney views this, and I think What You're Doing is kind of songs that he wrote thinking they could be singles and then decided they weren't up to snuff. So he himself has said negative things about these two songs, kind of like Lennon with 8 Days a Week. But I think Mac is being hard on these songs. I think that, I mean, not every song's going to be a number one hit. But, you know, as far as album tracks go, I think Every Little Thing's a great album track. And I love its bittersweet melodies. And I think it's a beautiful song. What do you think, Eric?
Oh, I fucking love this goddamn song. Every Little Thing She Does. Sweet, short, pretty little fucking love song, and I fucking love it, man. Reminds me of my beautiful fiance Mary. You know, you just that girl that, man, everything she does it for you. She cares about you. She always puts you, you know, she always puts you like, you know, as like a number one in their life, you know, and you know you're fucking lucky, you know. And it's just goddamn, I like this song just simply too because I am in love, man. I am currently in love, and so the song just resonates with me and resonates those feelings, man. I love my girl Mary. You know, she's awesome. The song makes me think of her, man. It's a pretty little ballad, so I mean, anyone listening to this episode, man, if you find that right one, you find that girl that makes you just feel so good inside, that, you know, makes you feel like you're the fucking king of the world, man. Like you'll love this song even that much more. Beautiful song by McCartney. McCartney, man, can write a good ass love song. He's definitely the more, you know, he can write a good sweet, you know, pretty little love song.
All right, nice. What do you say, Charles?
Let's see here. primarily written by Paul, and curiously, John is pretty much the primary singer, and that would be returned with Day Tripper, which was written by John, and Paul did the lion's share of the singing. And also, John does the primary electric guitar work here, which relegated George to acoustic guitar. And you get some timpani, which, you know, is another nod to the future here with some different instrumentation. But
yeah, it's a little like Proto Smashing Pumpkins. I didn't even think about that until now.
But unfortunately, other than that, this one falls a little flat for me. I think it happens to be the worst Lennon McCartney song on the record. It doesn't hold up or stack up against their best work. However, it blows Mr. Moonlight away. I will say that. So it's not the worst. But it's just kind of an album track, and I kind of agree with Paul. on the assessment.
All right. Again, next we're coming to another Lennon McCartney original, I Don't Want to Spoil the Party. Now, I love this song. My friend Richard Miller also brought up this song, said it was a underappreciated gem, and I totally 110% agree with him. In fact, this is my, I would say this is my fourth favorite song on the album after the first three, after like that initial, you know, run of those three songs. That trio you can't touch, in my opinion. But after those three songs, yeah, I think this is my favorite, and it's my favorite on the second side for sure. I get it why it's kind of an underdog, you know, kind of a dark horse song, although it was the B-side to 8 Days a Week. So at the time, in the mid-60s, this was probably the second most known song on the album because of that. And I think it's great. It has that quality. It's not as dark as the first three songs, but it has that acerbic John Lennon quality. You know, there's something acerbic about the lyrics. And again, this is like, this is music for guys that show up to parties that they say they don't want to spoil the party, but, you know, the subtext is they're going to fucking spoil the party.
Oh, shit.
And I don't know. I'm that kind of guy. I like it. It's like, hey, I'm either going to be the life of the party or the death of the party. It's your choice.
Oh, my God.
And John Lennon's that kind of guy. He's that guy. He's gonna
go. He would be. Yeah, it's gotta be all about him. If he's not happy, no one's gonna be happy.
Yeah. This is either gonna be the greatest party ever, or I'm gonna make it the worst. And I just love the sentiment. I love the bittersweet vibe. This, it all comes together here. A little Buddy Holly, a little Everly Brothers, a little Elvis. You know, all his influences, and even a little touch of Dylan. There's a little touch of Dylan in this too, I think. And it's an amazing song. I feel this is another song that I'm like, I feel if more people heard it, they would like it. To me, this sounds like a classic Beatles song, you know, but it's a classic Beatles song that a lot of people don't know, because this is the least, like, you know, popular Beatles album, but I love it. I think it's a hidden gem. What do you think, Charles?
Originally written for Ringo to perform, and apparently it was done live somewhere. I don't know. I read that somewhere, and you know, before it was recorded in the studio. And obviously, this is John on lead vocals. I'm going to hazard a guess. I bet George Martin guided that John needed to sing it instead, and maybe because of Honey Don't too. I don't know. Vastly superior to Every Little Thing. We go slightly country here and features a nifty little George guitar solo. One of the better songs on the record and another quiet classic. We touched on that in GNR. Quiet classic here. I fucking love it. One of my favorite songs on the record.
Right. Oh, I love that phrase. That's a great phrase, Charles. Quiet classic. Yeah, I agree. So it sounds like we're on the same page with that one. Awesome. So, Eric, what about you? What do you think of I Don't Want to Spoil the Fucking Party?
Oh, I fucking love this song, man. I'll tell you what, the song's not going to spoil the fucking party. The song's great. I fucking love it. And, I didn't know that about, you know, they were originally going to have Ringo sing the song, which, I love Ringo, but it works for John. I just can't picture Ringo pulling the song off like John did. You know, I love this damn song, and it truly reflects, like, sometimes how you feel after a breakup. Sometimes you just have that one breakup that just fucks you up, and, you know, you try and do something. You try and go to a party with some friends to get your mind off it, and you think, like, oh, man, you know, I'm gonna get over this shit, I'm gonna have fun, and, like, in reality, you don't. You just drag everyone's mood down. And, man, I've been on both sides of that spectrum, man. I've been the guy that ruined the party, and I've also been with friends who, like, ruined the fucking party, man. You know, it happens, man. Sometimes, man, sometimes there's that one girl that just fucks you up badly, man. And then sometimes you ruin a party because, man, you're just in such a somber mood that you just drag everyone down. But I love it, man. I love it. It's a great fucking song. Real fun. You know, musically it's really fun, but then, you know, lyrically it's, you know, kind of going back to that dark spot, you know, and, yeah, the album kind of goes back to that darkness, you know, because you kind of had, like, some more upbeat, like, some happier songs on the album, and then now you're back in, like, kind of the dark spot again, you know?
Nice, nice. Awesome. So we all love that song. It's Science. Moving on to another, I wouldn't call it a quiet classic, but better than it's given credit. You know, better than Macca gave credit to, because this I think this and Every Little Thing were the two songs he thought, I didn't really pull off what I was going for. I don't know. Listen, Paul, you can't, not every song could be a number one hit. Just fucking chill. Keep it in your pants. You know, sometimes something's just a melodic, catchy album track, all right? But What You're Doing is a great album track to me. And actually, I think one of the more musically progressive songs on the album. It starts off with that really cool drum beat. Got a little cool, like, little drum beat going on. And then the way the guitars, this is another one that has that kind of Birds-esque kind of hint of emerging psychedelia kind of coming in, especially with the way that that piano and that fade out, you know, and the guitar, George's guitar lines. There's something a little trippy about it, in my opinion. And even the lyrics, they have a little bit of that proto, it's like proto Rubber Soul to me, this song, in a lot of ways, both musically and even lyrically, because even though, yeah, it's Boy Meets Girl stuff, it's, there's that quality that a lot of, even the Boy Meets Girl songs on Rubber Soul has, where there's this, I would say it's like kind of like an existential crisis regarding it. It's like just something a little deeper and more abstract about the lyrics, you know. There's something like what you're doing. You know, it's like I'm looking through you. Like, it's that kind of thing, you know, or like, you know, or, you know, what's the one you mentioned, the George Harrison one, Charles?
Don't bother me.
Yeah, well, yeah, to think for yourself. I say, think for yourself. Yeah, think for yourself. Oh, I was confused. I confused those two songs earlier. Apologies for that. But anyway, yeah, I'm thinking about Think for Yourself and all that stuff and Looking Through You, I'm Looking Through You. This has that equality that reminds me of those songs, and they're doing it here in 1964. And I think it's a great, and I think McCartney's singing is very strong. I think it's one of his stronger vocal performances on the album. And there's about four or five songs I would put above it, but, you know, this is, you know, probably my sixth favorite. It's a strong track. And I think underrated by Macca and Beatle fans. And yeah, it just falls a little short of being a quiet classic. But it's definitely a strong album track. And I love it. What do you think, Charles?
It's Paul's last song on the record. And George dusted off his 12-string Rickenbacker. He didn't play it a lot on this record, but he did on here. And one of Ringo's better drumming tracks. Paul would cover ground like this again with, you know, obviously, or at the same time, actually, with She's a Woman and a song or two on Help. And the drum style would come back as well with, you hear similar things on Ticket to Ride and Tomorrow Never Knows. I enjoy the song. I don't think it's the best song in the album by any stretch, but it's definitely a song that points to the future sounds the band would go into. Another one of those bridging songs in the future. And I enjoy it quite a bit. But it's not the best song on the record, though. Cool. Album track.
Yeah, it sounds like, again, we're kind of more or less on the same page. Eric, what do you think of What You're Doing?
Oh, man, it's a great fucking song. And, you know, I believe Paul wrote this about Jane Asher, who they have very up and down relationship. I think she was honestly the prettier of the women Paul dated, honestly, you know, that beautiful redhead, you know. But I love this song, man. It's great, you know, song about, you know, you're with this girl and she treats you like shit, and it's like, you know, what the fuck, you know, I'm doing all this for you and you're just treating me like shit, you know. I've been there, done that, man, you know. I think we all have, you know, been with that girl. We do nothing but treat them great, and then they turn around and treat us like shit, you know. That's pretty much what Paul's singing about here, man. Great fucking song. I love it. Well, the way he sings it, and I believe this is one of those songs that, like, was influenced by him starting to do marijuana. You know, because I believe there's something he said about, like, you know, him, you know, starting to take marijuana helped him start thinking more clearly, and it kind of helped him, like, write this song, write these lyrics about, you know, his relationship with Jane Asher, which I believe he was starting to realize was not going too good.
Yeah, it makes sense. It sounds like a post-marijuana song. And yeah, Jane Asher inspired a lot of songs from
the mid-60s.
Even into Revolver, she was still inspired.
And a lot of different, and a lot of different style songs, man. There's a lot of lovey-dovey songs, but then a lot of, like, you know, breakup songs or, like, you know, we're fighting songs. So it's like, yeah, they are very, very, I guess, as the young kids would say, a toxic relationship. And, you know, I've been in some of those, man, you know. So yeah, I can relate, you know. But yeah, great song.
Nice. Okay, now we're getting to the album's finale, and I think a lot of people might think this is a weak ending. I don't. I'm not a lot of people. I actually think it's a strong ending, and it's probably my.
I agree.
I think it's like maybe I don't know. This rivals Honey Don't. Maybe this, you know, Honey Don't. I might knock down the third favorite cover. I think this is my second favorite cover. I really love Harrison's take on this Carl Perkins song, Everybody's Trying to Be My Baby, for a lot of reasons. I think this is a very strong cover. I think it's one of Harrison's best vocal performances from this period, from like his early days. I think it's a big jump forward for him as a singer. And it's he had Bite before, you know, Don't Bother Me, of course, it was like proto-punk rock. And, you know, on that album, you know, with the Beatles, he did that song. And I think he's kind of continuing. Even though it's a Carl Perkins song, it has a little bit of that same bite that he had in Don't Bother Me. And he sounds a little angry on the song. And I love the way he sings the lyrics in the beginning. And then when the song kicks in, and of course his guitar work, which we all have been praising throughout, his rockabilly guitar work. And I feel like it's kind of perfect after the last batch of songs. It's like, it's a cover, but it kind of fits in with this theme. You know, everybody's trying to be my baby. Like, there's this paranoid thing going on, you know? This is vibe. And I think in the context of this album, in the context of Harrison's delivery, the song seems a little darker to me. It has a little bit, maybe not as dark as Run For Your Life, you know, which I'm a big fan of. And so was George Harrison. George Harrison loved that song. And even though it was John Lennon's song, that was like one of his favorite John Lennon songs. This has a little bit of that vibe. I feel like it has a little bit of the vibe that song will later have. It sounds like some shit's going to go down, you know? It sounds like it's a deceptively... It's not like overtly menacing, but I don't know. I feel like some shit might go down after Harrison's done with the song. He's going to put down his guitar and, like, I don't know, like, fucking knife some chick's car's tires or something. he sounds pissed off. That's all I can say. What do you think, Charles?
Man, I hate to be the bad guy here, but if it wasn't for Mr. Moonlight, this would be the worst song on the album. But it's not. But it's not because of the song. Or George, it's because of the production.
You don't like the production? Wow.
I do not. I think it's because, again, I heard it live, the live version on Anthology, and you don't have all that god-awful echo. I don't know what they were doing with the production on this track. I'm not a fan of it. I prefer just to hear the George version that would be on Anthology 1 or numerous live versions. The song is fine, just not a fan of the production. I guess they were trying to make it sound like Sun Studio or something like that. Norman Smith, I thought, was not the best engineer they ever had. He engineered this album. Jeff Emmerich would come on board not too long after this, but I really don't like it just because of the production. It's not a shit song like Mr. Moonlight, but just... No, not a fan of the production.
All right, fair enough. I respectfully disagree. I like the echo. I like that. I think they do achieve the Sun Studio sound, but you know, but fair enough. Might not be Plastic Ono Band level echo, but
yeah.
But I think it's decent echo. Eric, what do you think of Everybody's Trying to Be My Motherfucking Baby? And I'm going to cut your fucking tires, bitch.
Dude, George Harrison can be a fucking asshole in some of his songs. Yeah. Like everybody's trying to, like, he's just like all like, oh man, all these bitches are all on me, man. I got all these hoes on me. And it's too much. Bitch, get away from me. I need to breathe. You know, like
bitches to leave all the time. Don't bother me.
Think for yourself. What was the other one? If I need someone, if I need someone, I'll date you. But you know, not right now, bitch. Like I'll call you when I need you. George Harrison's kind of an asshole, but man, even though he's an asshole, he writes some good songs or does covers of good songs, and this is one of them, man. Holy shit, great fucking cover, man. I mean, George Harrison can do some pretty good covers when he needs to. Man, just great fucking song, and I think it's a great way to end the album. I think What You're Doing is a great song, and if they closed it with that song, it still would have been a great album. But I think you got to kind of end it with something maybe just a little bit upbeat, it's been kind of a dark album for the most part. It's upbeat, but lyrically it's kind of dark because he's like telling all these bitches to get away from him, you know? Yeah, it's funny. This is kind of like how rap songs are nowadays. Like, oh, I got all these hoes on me, and like these bitches won't leave me alone. All these hoes want my money, you know. Like, it's kind of like a rap song, but like it's actually like good, you know.
I love how you say these days. You mean like the past 30 years?
Yeah, it's sad. It's true. It's true. But oh man, young people music, like young people music.
The music these kids have been listening to for like 30 something years.
But yeah, like, hey, yo, bitch, got me on my cell phone. Give me them digits.
Come on. Yeah, this is everybody's trying to be my baby. In parentheses, get to stepping, bitch.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love it, man. I think it's a cool way to end the album, man. I love it. Man, what a fucking underrated fucking album, man. More people need to listen to this fucking Beatles album because it fucking kicks ass, man. Even the songs I don't like, I think are still pretty solid if you listen to it the whole way through as an album. Fucking love it, man. This is a great album. I'm glad we got to talk about this one.
Yeah, I mean, I love With the Beatles, and that, like, there are times that rivals, like, I sometimes bounce between that With the Beatles and Beatles for Sale as my fourth and fifth favorite Beatles album. But more often than not, it's usually Beatles for Sale, especially because of the first three songs. That usually edges it out. And thinking about it and listening to it, I listened to it twice today before doing this. It's definitely, Beatles for Sale. I'm locking it in there. It's locked in. Fourth place. Definitely my fourth favorite Beatles album. And it's definitely my favorite Beatles, pre-Rubber Soul Beatles album. And... yeah, more people should fucking listen to this album. Fucking stop being a poser, people. Don't just listen to the hits. Listen to fucking Beatles for Sale. Buy that shit.
Also, listen to more pre-Rubber Soul stuff. Give the Beatlemania era a fucking chance. Because, man, there's some solid shit in there, man. Some good shit.
Yeah. Charles, any closing thoughts on this album and this era before we get to our recommendations?
Man. Well, I agree with what you guys are saying. All eras of the Beatles are fantastic, and again, even I don't judge this album as greatly as Eddie on my all-time list, but it's still the Beatles. It's still fantastic. I liken it to 70s Kiss. There's nothing bad. So it's just because I might like this a little less than, say, Rubber Soul, Revolver, Abbey Road, whatever, it doesn't matter. It's still the Beatles. It's still fantastic. Check it out.
Awesome. Okay, Charles, and anything you've been, like, vibing with this week? Anything you'd like to recommend? An album, movie, whatever,
Definitely been on a huge Johnny Thunders kick. I know, Eric loves him.
God, fuck Johnny Thunders.
There's a live album called Too Much Junkie Business that I think people should check out. It actually sounds fantastic too. I guess it was remastered, and it's one of the, maybe not the quality of the songs per Eric maybe or to others, but the sound of it is phenomenal. It's one of the better live albums as far as sonically I've heard in a long time. So Too Much Junkie Business, one of my favorites, Johnny Thunders.
Nice. Well, you can't put your arms around a dream. I think... Listen, don't hold the fucking Spaghetti Incident version against it. The original Johnny Thunders version is amazing. I think it's a great song. What do you think, Drew? I love that song.
It's
good. So don't hold Duff McKagan. Don't hold Johnny Thunders,
There's a great version of that on this album, and it's acoustic. So, acoustic live. So... Nice. Can't put your arms around a memory. Hell yeah.
Yeah, I'm a fan. I like a lot of stuff. But I'm not actually a big New York Dolls guy, but I prefer Johnny Thunders without them afterwards.
I actually agree. I kind of like the Thunder stuff a lot more than the New York Dolls. So, but I don't hate the New York Dolls, but I do prefer the Thunder stuff.
There you go. Okay, great. Great, and I'm going to recommend, you know what, I'm recommending this, something just general, it's a little different, normally I go specific albums, I'm telling people listen to fucking Buddy Holly, listen to Buddy Holly, like Eric, I'm a huge Buddy Holly fan. Now this thing, like a lot of these 50s artists, they're not entirely album oriented, you know, Elvis was a little bit to a degree, but most, and like you had like other kinds of music, like Frank Sinatra and jazz artists were album oriented. But most rock, most of these 50s rock and roll guys, you know, they just released singles or EPs. And then when they had enough songs, you know, the label would kind of compile an album. And a lot of Buddy Holly stuff is like that. So, I mean, if I would recommend, there's the Definitive Collection. It's just called like Buddy Holly and the Crickets, the Definitive Collection. That pretty much, it puts together all the stuff you would want. You know, he only lived for a couple of years. You know, obviously, tragically, he died.
Yeah.
Way too soon. Because I mean, obviously, anyone that dies young dies too soon. But I really think Buddy Holly is someone who, if he had lived, I don't think he would have been just like some 50s rock and roll guy. I feel like he might have developed into being like a Bob Dylan or John Lennon if he had lived. I feel like he is the proto Lennon / Dylan in a lot of ways. You know, even in terms of the image, like the way they wore glasses, and he was kind of, he had this outsider, like the geeky outsider rock and roll guy that I feel would have developed along with the 60s. Like I could see him growing his hair long and wearing the glasses and kind of doing what John Lennon eventually did. Yeah. You know? And, you know, he was such an ingenious songwriter. He had such songwriting. And like Lennon McCartney, everything this guy sang and wrote was, you know, ear candy. You know, he had such a great sense of melody. He really straddled that line between country and rock and roll, like Elvis, a lot early Elvis did. The early stuff was technically the Crickets. And then it would later, people would refer to it as like Buddy Holly and the Crickets. And I mean, I probably like the early stuff the best. But, you know, and if you had to get, like, if you had to get a, you know, Buddy Holly album, probably the first one. But I really think you need to get the, like, a Definitive Collection. Whatever best, greatest hits you could see that has the most songs, get that. You know, my favorite 50s song of all time is, there's a lot, but I'm trying to think. I think it's Not Fade Away. I'm thinking about this. Yeah, Not Fade Away is my favorite 50s song. And that's a Buddy Holly song. That's my favorite Buddy Holly. The Stones do a good version of it, but not as good as the Buddy Holly version. I love when they play it in the beginning of Christine, one of my favorite movies, John Carpenter's Christine. And in the bop, 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 there's something very eerie about that. And I think Buddy Holly kind of is proto-Beatles for Sale. And it's no wonder that they covered him on this album. Is his stuff has a darkness, and again, maybe that a little of that's being projected into it because how he died young and tragically. But I don't know, I feel there is a dark undercurrent to a lot of Buddy Holly material. Now, he has like some songs that they released after he died, and some of them, you know, became hits, and they put like orchestration around them and stuff. And they're a little candy ass. I don't think those songs would have sounded that way if Buddy had lived. But even then, they still have beautiful melodies. Yeah, but still, even with that kind of corny, kind of Pleasantville, kind of Leave It to Beaver kind of musical backdrop, it's such a beautiful melody. It's got that quality, like we talk about the McCartney stuff, like Follow the Sun. Every Day has that. It's just pure melody. Buddy Holly's an amazing songwriter.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the greats. One of the great songwriters who was definitely, tragically,
taken way too soon.
Way too soon, because I think he would have kept on evolving. And also, Lou Reed's another artist I think took a lot from Buddy Holly, and he cited Buddy Holly as a big influence. So a lot of songwriters, guys that were about lyrics, you know, they all, like, all these guys grew up as kids growing up listening to Buddy Holly. It was a very big influence. And yeah, more people should listen to Buddy Holly. So check out some fucking Buddy Holly.
By the way, did you ever hear the Waylon Jennings? He did a track on one of his albums where he did a medley of Buddy Holly songs.
I fucking love it
because he played bass for Buddy Holly.
That's true. He was going to be on that plane.
Yeah.
Famously, that flight. But he flipped a coin, and because of a flipped coin, Waylon Jennings did not die. He would have been on that flight because he was the bassist for the Crickets. Him and Buddy Holly came from the same town in Texas. And yeah, and Waylon Jennings always talked up Buddy Holly because it was his first big break in the music business. You know? And he always respected him. And that's right. Yeah, in the late 70s, a great album. I've Always Been Crazy by Waylon Jennings. On that album is where he has the tribute to Buddy Holly. Buddy Holly does this medley, and it's great. It's a great medley, and he did a great job. But I still love with Buddy Holly. It's rare. I almost always love the original versions the best. You know. So
yeah.
So that's my recommendation. And Eric, what would you like to recommend?
Before I give my recommendation, I'm always going to do a shout out to my beautiful fiance Mary, who she actually listens to the podcast, man. She listens to every episode, and I love her for that. You know, she's very supportive. So baby, I love you. And yeah, I'm going to go ahead and recommend. I did a review on the Freeform Rock podcast of a Ted Nugent album, Double Live Gonzos, which might be out by the time this episode comes out. But ever since then, man, I've been on a big, big Ted Nugent kick, and I'm gonna go with kind of the dark horse album, Weekend Warriors. It's the first album with Charlie Hunt on vocals, who now sings for Foghat. And I think Derek St. Holmes is amazing. I think Charlie Hunt does a good job. And man, that fucking album, great album cover. And it's just chock full of classics, man. Need You Bad, Tight Spots, Good Friends and a Bottle of Wine. And it has the two fucking epics on the album back to back, Smokescreen and Venom Soup, which are just real dark and almost Stranglehold-esque. I fucking love that album. I think it's very underrated. It's just, from top to bottom, a great, great fucking record. I think really, the one of the last great Ted Nugent albums. I mean, he had a couple good ones afterwards, but that was kind of really the last of, classic Ted, man, in my opinion. So, yeah, that's my recommendation is Weekend Warriors by none other than Uncle Ted Nugent. And I'll give, if you hate his politics, it's one thing, but goddammit, give his music a chance, because his music's fucking amazing.
Hey, I agree. This is why I think people should separate, an artist's politics from their music.
Well,
I think Ted Nugent's one of the main reasons why you should do that.
Oh yeah. Oh dude, I mentioned
because he is so good in the '70s. Yeah, he's great.
I mentioned in that Freeform episode, I'm like, man, even back in the day before people really before people were so divided and hating on each other for politics, even back then, before people were really like that, people just hated on Ted Nugent for his political views. Even before, the kind of climate we live in nowadays, where, you have one opinion, this side hates you, and this person has this opinion, this side hates you now. It's just God damn, can we just all get along and listen to some good music? What the fuck?
Right. Yeah, Ted Nugent managed to be. Seem extremely right wing to people even during the Reagan era. He's shooting bows and arrows with the American flag on stage and but yeah, listen, I've always been about the music, and I love shit that's gonzo, as people know. And here's a fucking one of the most gonzo rockers of all time, even as in the title, Double Gonzo Life. But yeah, that's a great album. I think that's a great recommendation. I love Weekend Warriors as well. I'll just say this. We'll save this for when we do a Ted Nugent episode at some point. But I love every Ted Nugent album from the 70s, even into the, I'd say,
early 80s.
Yeah, early 80s. I like Scream Dream a lot.
That's a great album. That was 1980, so I mean, that's still technically 70. That's that transition period.
Yeah. So I guess Intensities and Ten Cities is the okay. So we're saying early 80s. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Intensities and Ten Cities is the last great. I think that's the last great Ted Nugent album. That's my favorite.
I do have a fondness for Spirit of the Wild. That one had a couple. That was when Derek St. Holmes came back in the band. That one had a couple of good songs on it. It's not 70s Nugent though, but I mean it had a couple of pretty decent songs on there.
All right. Well, we'll say this. We're going to pick a Ted Nugent album in the future. So there you go. Some people are going to be triggered. We're going to do a Ted Nugent episode.
Yeah. Well, hey, even if people are triggered by it, they'll listen to it. People like to listen to shit that'll piss them off. So, hey, maybe we can turn on some people to Ted Nugent.
That's all right. Sounds good. Anyway, this was a great episode. Charles, thank you so much.
Hell yeah.
And this one, we promise. Eric, promise Charles. Well, at least.
Oh, I'm saving this shit. I'm very wide awake. I'm saving it on my phone and the laptop.
All right, we will not lose this one, Charles. We promise.
Cool.
Hell yeah!
Always fun to be on, dudes, and love talking about the Beatles. So thanks for having me back.
Oh yeah, and everyone, check out Charles is on this podcast called Freeform Rock Podcast. Isn't that what it's called?
Correct.
There you go. So check out Freeform Rock Podcast with Charles Chuck Travion.
Yeah. And Eddie and Eric have both guested many times, so we all support each other on these shows. So yeah, check it out. Mark and Jerry BS as well, and just keep on rocking, folks, as always.
All right, right on. Later, everyone.
Later. Good night.
Thanks, guys.